We are still waiting for members to arrive, but I think we must proceed because we are scheduled to start at 8:30, and it is now almost  9:10. So it's not fair for those who came very early in the morning, hoping that we will start exactly at 8:30, and now those that have invited the guests are not here. There's three members, including myself. The other members are not here. I don't know what is happening. I did receive an apology from the whip of the committee, Honorable Mokacha, that she will be attending the memorial service of one of our members of parliament, the Deputy Minister of Minerals and Energy, Honorable Bavelile Hlongwa, who passed on. The ANC caucus had arranged a prayer service from 8:30 to, I think, to 9:30. So some of the members of the ANC caucus might be attending that memorial service. But the rest of the members, I don't know what's happening to them. So we are going to start. The attendance is also not very good. This is our first in a series of colloquiums that we'll be having, and it does look like we are not starting on a high note. So let's hope that as we proceed, the attendance will be much better, because the intention is for us to have as many voices as possible participating and interacting with the topic, because we'd learn more from the many voices that should necessarily form part of this discussion. So we are going to start now. I think for now we will, before we start with all the formalities, I'll start with the apologies and then allow that all those who are attendees must just briefly introduce themselves so that we know who's here. Unfortunately, the minister won't be here. Minister Nzimande, the Minister of Higher Education, Science and Technology, is part of the delegation of the president at the OR Tambo District Municipality there, launching the district model of government delivery by the president. So unfortunately, the minister would not be here. The deputy minister, as I'm told, is also overseas. He's traveling abroad together with the deputy, the DG of Science and Innovation, I understand. He's also traveling abroad. And the deputy, the Director General of Higher Education and Training, is attending to some crisis at the University of Zululand. So those are the apologies. Unfortunately, they come from the key stakeholders who are supposed to be here. We would have liked to have a keynote address from the minister as we start this colloquium, but unfortunately, there's nothing he could do. I spoke to him yesterday, so there was no way that he could come here. The president asked them to be there. There's 18 ministers, apparently. a number of deputy ministers who are there at the OR Tambo. So it's quite a big event that is taking place there. Multidisciplinary functions, government departments, all of them descended at OR Tambo. Hopefully as they leave that part of our country, things will be much better than how they found them. So my name is Fili Mapulane. I'm the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education, Science and Technology. We still call it Science and Technology ourselves as the Portfolio Committee until further notice. Until the name of the ministry has changed, we know that the department is now called Department of Science and Innovation. So there's two members here that you have elected, but I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves. As others come, they will also introduce themselves. And then we'll take our guest and then proceed with the program. Honorable Gates.
Thank you very much. It's Peter Gates, Member of Parliament from the EFF.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Lulama Chaisa, an alternate member to this committee from AIC.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take the intro from here. Or you can start there.
Thank you, Chair. It's Daniel Fisser from the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research.
Good morning, Chair and members. Nimrod Zalk from the Department of Trade and Industry.
Okay. Thank you. It will be nicer to also hear the designation.
From the CEO of the
Okay, and Nimrod?
I'm Industrial Development Advisor in the Office of the Director General.
I'm Group Manager for Planning and Knowledge Management within the CSR. I also head up all of our activities around Fourth Industrial Revolution.
Chair. Thank you. Chair. I think he must switch on the mic because...
Oh, for recording, yeah?
Thank you.
CEO.
It's Crane Sodin, CEO of the HSRC.
Thank you.
Himmler Studio, Executive Officer of the Academy of Sciences of South Africa.
Thank you.
Good morning, members and colleagues. My name is Trudy van Wyk. I'm from the Department of Higher Education and Training, and I'm Chief Director heading up the Fourth Industrial Revolution activities of DIET. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Hashila Narsi. I'm Acting DDG for Planning in the Department of Higher Education and Training.
Brenda Ntombela from the Human Resource Development Council Secretariat. I'm heading the Secretariat in the Department of Education and Training.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. Elia Madigane from the CSIR Parliamentary Liaison Office, and I'm the Senior Stakeholder Engagement Officer.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and Members. My name is Lucian Kearns. I'm the Acting CFO within the Department of Higher Education and Training.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Malivu Olumka. I'm the Chief Director in the Department of Higher Education and Training, responsible for CITAS.
Good morning. My name is Faisal Tofi. I'm in the Office of the Director General, Chief Director.
Good morning. I'm Thelma Oppold from the Human Sciences Research Council. I'm a PhD intern in the Education and Skills Development Research Program.
Good morning. I'm Michael Gastra. I'm a Chief Research Specialist at the Human Sciences Research Council.
Good morning, Chair. Members, I'm Charlene Swartz. I'm the Executive Director of the Education and Skills Program at the Human Sciences Research Council.
Thank you.
Morning, Chair and everyone. My name is Portia Mange. I'm representing the principal organization. I'm acting principal Kharsi Bandi Tivet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Vian Mini. I'm here representing the executive officer of the National Skills Fund. I'm also within the National Skills Fund, working closely with the Skills Development Branch. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Mr. Muzin Lobo from the Department of Basic Education. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Who else?
Imran Patel. I'm a Deputy Director General at the Department of Science and Innovation.
Tegrin Govender. I'm CIO for Mercantile Bank, and I chair the Council for Higher Education's IT steering group.
Okay. Are we done? You can also introduce yourself, sir.
Good morning, members and the delegation from the various departments. My name is Yalaman Gipi. I'm a researcher from KMG. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Marco Schmidt. I work for the German Consulate General in Cape Town. I'm the Parliamentary Liaison Officer.
Morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Babulele Bingwa from the Ministry of Higher Education, Science and Technology.
Hi, good morning. My name is Aitin Anthony. I'm from the DG's office. I'm a parliamentary officer. I just want to apologise. Our official is on her way now. She's just stuck in traffic.
Okay. Official from?
From the Department of Communication.
Okay. All right. Thank you all. We've got some...
Thanks, Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Paul Davids. I'm with the Deputy Speaker's office. 4IR Project Anchor, and he did indicate that he's on his way. Thanks.
Agnetha Ardenser, Research for Higher Education for the committee.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we now know who's in the house. maybe I must just start with my brief input, honorable members, invited guests. Ladies and gentlemen, as I said, that we are commencing with the first in a series of colloquiums that this portfolio committee will host on a quarterly basis to interrogate the topical issues in the higher education, science and technology sector during our tenure here in the 6th Parliament. We hope to create a platform to facilitate national conversations and dialogue among all the key stakeholders in the sector around the vexing questions of the day. We hope to contribute our part in making this parliament not only a people's parliament, but a true activist parliament capable of confronting the contemporary questions facing society and coming up with collective solutions. Under the theme, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, Education, Skills and Innovation, we are hoping to unpack the significance of the Fourth Industrial Revolution in the context of higher education, science and innovation, which is the portfolio we are responsible for its oversight. The Fourth Industrial Revolution represents a fundamental way change in the way we live, work and relate to one another. It will affect aspects related to our sense of privacy, our notions of ownership, our consumption patterns, the time we devote to work and leisure, how we develop our careers and cultivate our skills, and meet, it's technology, honorable members. How we develop our careers and cultivate our skills and meet people and nurture relationships. The fourth industrial revolution was spearheaded in the first industrial revolution rather was spearheaded in England with the introduction of railways and steam engines, which culminated in mechanical production. And the second industrial revolution was driven by the United States, which, with ideas emanating from England, and focused largely on generating electricity, which today defines much of the mechanized utility in daily human life. And that's modes of transport and all electrical appliances and conveniences. It largely impacted and improved modes of production for goods and related services. And the third focused on electronic technologies and was also initiated in and advanced in the US, which cumulatively transformed the information and communication sector. And this significantly affected the use of fixed and mobile communication, which is phones, televisions, and computers. It is often referred to as the computer or digital revolution. And the fourth revolution zooms into digital technologies and builds on the digital revolution and is driven by robotics, genetic sequencing and editing, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, just to mention a few. Along this digital trajectory, everything around us will be automated. The various forms of artificial intelligence can extensively contribute towards the improvement of quality of life, but must be underpinned and guided by a strong regulatory regime to ensure a balanced and responsible use of these technologies. The 4IR is a new chapter in human development, enabled by extraordinary technological advances, matching those of the first, second, and the third industrial revolutions combined. These advances are merging the physical, digital, and biological worlds in ways that create both huge opportunity and potential threat. The speed, breadth, and depth of this revolution is forcing us to rethink how countries develop, how organizations create value, and even what it means to be human. For the post-school education and training sector, the NDP envisaged that by 2030, South Africans should have access to education and training of the highest quality. The education, training, and innovation system should thus cater for different needs and produce highly skilled individuals and those who qualify through the post-school education system should have adequate skills and knowledge to meet the current and future needs of the economy and society. The NDP further states that South Africa's national system of innovation needs to be expanded and to be more effective. It must be aligned with the sectors that will realize the country's growth objectives. This therefore requires that, as articulated in the National Development Plan, South Africa should invest 1.5% of the GDP in research and development, and that science and technology innovation, institutional arrangements must improve the link between innovation and the productive needs of the industry, and that government should collaborate with the private sector to raise the level of R&D in companies. The discourse on the fourth industrial revolution has gained momentum over the past year, with President Ramaphosa appointing a presidential commission on the fourth IR to ensure that we effectively and with greater agency harness the technological change in pursuit of inclusive growth and social development. The commission comprises of eminent persons drawn from different sectors of society will coordinate the development of South Africa's National Response Action Plan to deal with the 4IR. In addition, especially for our sector, a ministerial task team has been established to advise the Minister of Higher Education, Science and Innovation on how to manage the threats and opportunities posed by the fourth industrial revolution to the sector. Now, we have divided this or categorize or structured the program of this colloquium into four sub-themes. Now, the first theme, we are posing a question: what is the 4IR and how will it impact the science, technology, and innovation and post-school education and training sectors? It is anticipated that the fourth industrial revolution will cause widespread disruption not only to business models but also to labor markets, with enormous change predicted in the skill sets needed to thrive in the new landscape. It therefore necessitates that countries develop new policies, strategies, and innovation plans to enable an inclusive societal approach, with government having a leadership responsibility. And as such, education and skills development remain key priority. Young people should be prepared for the jobs of the future through skills like coding, robotics, and data analytics, among others, to optimally participate in the future economy. The next sub-theme, we want to talk to the role of PSET and STI sectors towards building skills for an innovation-based economy and a decolonized education system. Now, according to the White Paper on Post-School Education and Training of 2013, the post-school system is understood as comprising all education and training provision for those who have completed school, those who did not complete their schooling, and those who have never attended school. There is a need for a system that can cater for all needs of millions of young people who are not in employment, education, or training. Furthermore, the 4IR presents many opportunities to the discourse on colonization of education in South Africa. For example, the current curricula is, to a large extent, no longer relevant, and thus brings about urgent need for curriculum reform in basic to higher education, and that includes a review and change of pedagogy, methodologies, and practice. This opportunity creates a platform for intense dialogue on reconceptualizing curriculum, especially in the context of the 4IR. There is a need to do things differently to strengthen and enhance the status quo, and a critical debate is required to unpack what it means to decolonize education. The third sub-theme, we want to talk to the future skills forecasting for new industrial revolution, the impact of 4IR on reskilling, retraining in the workplace. Now, there's a huge burden on the education system to prepare learners and the citizenry as a whole for an uncertain future workforce. Curriculum development needs a radical shift to accommodate the potential curriculum needs that speaks to the increasingly technology-driven economy. For example, all learners will require proficiency in science, technology, engineering, maths, what is called STEM, and digital literacy. Teachers should be able to teach to develop character, confidence, critical thinking, and creativity, and teach in a way that encourages a joy for learning and discovery, and instill a love for STEM subjects. Reskilling, retraining, including upskilling, is therefore an imperative to prepare the workforce for future jobs created by the 4IR. For an example, it is anticipated that new technologies will disrupt existing jobs and create new jobs. This implies, therefore, a significant shift in workplace duties that would be performed by machines and robots. However, it also brings many opportunities, since new jobs will also be created through manufacturing and operation of these machines. And in addition, automation would have an impact on the nature of work, that is, permanent versus contract, insourcing versus outsourcing, yet there would still be a demand for roles which require human skills. So we hope, honorable members and ladies and gentlemen, invited guests, that we will engage in intelligent and informative discussion, both to educate ourselves about this complex subject and to help to facilitate a smooth and seamless transition. So that is what we hope to achieve with this colloquium. So this is a platform created for us to debate. It is the first, as I said, in a series that we'll be following, where we'll be choosing topical issues in the space and interrogating the issues there. So we, as I said, we could not get the minister, so Imran Patel has been asked on behalf of the minister just to say a few words as a form of a keynote. But before I allow you, Imran, I must say that initially the program was very congested because we could not obtain an approval to sit for the whole day. As you know, this afternoon there is a sitting at 2. But yesterday we did speak to the leadership here, to the chief whip and so forth, who gave us that permission that we should be could be here until we finish our program. So although we still have to be time conscious, but we don't necessarily have to push that we must finish at 2. But I know for other members, their party may require that they should be in the house irrespective of the permission granted to us to be here until we finish our work. And we'll respect the party mandate if they will have to leave to go and attend. But yeah, we hope that it's going to be a very interesting discussion. Lots of speakers, about 10 speakers, all in all, throughout the day. A variety of speakers from Labour. We're expecting Tony Ehrenreich to be here to put across the perspective of COSAT. We were not able to accommodate the students, South African Union of Students, because of the tight timeline. I'm told they are here. They've prepared the presentation, so we're going to allow them to talk to us because we've got a little bit of time now. So, Imran. Yeah, you can sit here.
Good morning, and I think my voice is going soon. Thanks, Chairperson, for giving the opportunity just to say a few comments. As the Chairperson indicated, the Minister has been called to attend the launch of the district integrated district service delivery model in OR Tambo today. It's going to be a radical shift in the way that government operates, trying to force the coordination. And the reason why I wanted to start there was that it kind of illustrates what we need to be doing in the 4R space. The issue of coordination, and I'll just touch on this briefly later, is core to any attempt by any government to be able to, or any society to take forward what it wants to do. So the Minister has been asked to attend that and couldn't attend. I also did not have a chance to engage with the Ministry on issues, but over the last 2 weeks I've had occasion to have a discussion with both the Minister and the Deputy Minister on 4R issues, particularly in the context of the WEF Centre, and some sense of the kind of key issues that they would have raised should they have been here. So let me go through some of those. The first comment that I want to make is in fact, history is playing quite an important role in thinking about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. People
As we problem solve for what we're wanting to do, people have gone back to lessons from the first, second, and third industrial revolution to understand better. Those revolutions were in fact not coordinated in the way that we want to do now. There was less directionality, things happened, electricity happened, etc. Societies have grown and understood both the benefits but the threats of different industrial revolutions. And one thing that characterizes this current industrial revolution is an attempt by society to shape the direction in a much more cohesive way. And that's why you have things like this, the colloquiums, or even forums where people are thinking about what this means. But just to illustrate this fourth industrial revolution and what it means, people look, some commentators have looked at parliamentary democracies and have come to the conclusion that parliamentary democracies, in the way that we've shaped things, where you have a parliament with a sitting like this, in fact is a consequence of how societies evolved at a particular point in time and the fact that technologies were not developed to the extent that they needed to. So we had smaller communities, we had the small councils, people used to be able to vote on every decision. Society started growing larger and larger. That model couldn't exist anymore. And therefore, the concept of representative democracy came up because there was no way for every citizen to vote on every issue. Some of that is beginning to change. In a place like Italy, there's a party that is looking at how to use technology to allow every citizen to vote on all issues. How this will pan out is something that we would need to look at. So everything, our institutions, our university systems, the structure of families, the structure of cities, etc., are very closely aligned to the nature of the industrial revolution that is coming up. So the first step that we need to do is to understand the nature of the current industrial revolution, and there's many speakers, including Daniel and I, who've been working on some of this, so I'm not going to go into the 4R, the presentation done this effectively, but there is one point that I want to just highlight, and that is the issue of the nature of the technologies shaping this industrial revolution. And I think, Chairperson, you had correctly highlighted that it's both about digital technologies, but a set of other technologies that may be a bit less developed, but are on the way to becoming quite radical in terms of the change that it can make. A particular area of focus is the biological technologies, genomics, gene sequencing, etc. All of those are emerging technologies that are at the cutting edge of really changing things, but also a whole set of digital, physical technologies, whether it's 3D printing, etc., which in some way will change the nature of production. So this fourth industrial revolution is the set of a range of technologies, both digital and others, that has two characteristics that then has an impact in terms of how we respond. The first is that the speed of change across these technology areas is unprecedented just because of the number of people working on these technologies globally. There are millions of R&D workers now that shape these kinds of technologies. So it's the speed of change, and then the second issue is that it's happening on a wide range of fronts where these fronts are connecting with each other. So the digital technologies is spurring on what's happening in the biological space in terms of the ability to do gene sequencing faster. That, in fact, is driving change in terms of data that can be collected to do health in a better way. This convergence, together with the speed across a wide range of fronts, implies three things for us that I think we need to focus on in this colloquium and others. The first is, how do we position governance in this space? And there's a concept that the WEF uses called agile governance, which is something to say that it's impossible to do the cycles of governance changes, institutional changes. If the technology is moving fast, these things have to have a new approach to be able to do this. And the concept of learning by doing, by setting something in place,
but quickly correcting needs to come to the fore. And this is quite important in terms of the regulatory front, because you need to ensure that you prevent unintended consequences, but at the same time not to cut the potential of these technologies to make positive change. So agile governance is a crucial issue. The second is the issue of coordination, because these technologies and this is a good way to illustrate the topic of this. How is the 4R impacting on science, technology, and skills development? And in a way, science, technology, and skills development also affects the direction of the fourth industrial revolution. This coordination that needs to happen between sectors, between the policy environment and the technology development is crucial, and I think all countries are struggling with this, including South Africa. I think we are making some good movements around this, and this colloquium is a very, very good instrument to be able to bring people together, because in fact you need all of the voices that are impacted by this to shape this together, and you need to get that kind of coordination. In government, we are aware of the developments like the district model or the presidential commission. That's all beginning to try to address this coordination gap. But we're quite a far away from having the kind of optimal coordination, but we would be able to do this. And then the third issue that's crucial for us to engage on is, because this fourth industrial revolution is so wide-ranging, covers a whole range of areas, focus becomes crucial and important. In South Africa, because of the system that we've developed, we have very good capabilities on the science and innovation side around particular niche areas. So we're aware, Daniel will present us, we have some teams looking at robotics, looking at artificial intelligence, looking at data science, looking at genomics. So across the areas that WEF and others have identified as driving the fourth industrial revolution, South Africa has capabilities in those areas. The problem with our capabilities is they're very small, and sometimes they're not necessarily targeted to what Chairperson, you highlighted, which I think is the crucial point, to where we should be making changes in terms of our social and economic development priorities. And that challenge, I think, is beginning to be addressed. So the focus is important so that we are able to grow our science and technology system and our skills development system in ways that doesn't put pressure on both of those systems, because as a country of only 50 million people on the southern tip of Africa, we are a very small player in the bigger scheme of things. I was sharing with Daniel earlier on, for example, in 5G, there's been some discussions based on the trade war between China and the US around Huawei making an offer to make available all of their technologies to a competing company. And in that article, they spoke about the amount that Huawei has invested just in 5G research, and it was in the order of $2 billion. In South Africa, we have some 5G capabilities, but it's a size of, you know, a very small unit in CSR combined with some private sector element. So in these areas, you quickly become isolated if you don't have focus. And there are areas that we need to focus on, which is part of what the Science and Innovation Mandate is trying to do with its decadal plan, and then working very closely with our colleagues in DTI and DCTT to see whether we can shape certain areas. The areas that are coming up, and this is the second last point that I would want to end on, is there are areas of opportunity that we need to really focus on and think hard about. The first clear area is the skills area in itself. And we had a very good bilateral engagement with our colleagues in our sister department now in higher education and training, and this conversation started emerging in that discussion. That our educational challenges, the fact that we have large numbers of people who need to be trained, the models that we need to be trained on, in fact gives us an opportunity to design the technologies that will shape those kinds of things and not rely on overseas technologies. We can become a world leader in what is called EdTech. And this has come up from a number of players. The second is our health burden. And there are very, very important opportunities in the health sector. We have a very vibrant medical devices community. We also have very strong capabilities in what we have a diverse genetic pool, and that is a competitive advantage. So health is another kind of crucial area. The third is mining beneficiation as an area of focus. We have a partnership with industry called the Mandela Mining Precinct, where we're looking at the next generation of mining. And a key area is to look at 4R technologies in the context of mining. Agriculture remains an important area, but here there are other world leaders. We would need to think very carefully about what we would need to do. And I would then argue that it's around small-scale farmers and others in a sense. And then finally, the area that the President has raised, and that is how do we start reimagining our living spaces, our cities, our rural areas in terms of 4R. So there seems to be in a number of conversations these things are emerging, but it's very important that we soon begin to focus in on the areas that will allow us to shape our science and innovation system and our higher education and training system in a way that moves to particular areas and then partner smartly with the global community around the areas that we're not able to do because we need to do that. The final comment that I want to make is in all of this technological discussions, and again this colloquium has been put together very well and thanks to the organizers, that we need to focus on the diversity of issues. It's not a technological revolution, it's a social revolution. And in fact, I'm not too sure if Michael is going to be brave enough to raise this debate again, is whether we in fact are using the wrong terminology to talk about what we're wanting to do. The fourth industrial revolution has a particular connection, largely defined by people like the World Economic Forum and others, but globally they are competing philosophical approaches around this, including, for example, Japan doesn't talk about the fourth industrial revolution, they talk about society 5.0, because part of the issue is that this is not just an industrial revolution, it's not just going to change production systems, it's going to change societal systems. So do we have the right terminology to be able to focus on? For all intents and purposes, I think it's fine to talk about the 4R, but in our debates, I think we need to evolve our own terminology at the end of the day. It's a very powerful way of defining an inclusive agenda that takes forward what we would need to do. So the presentations, the participation by agencies like the Human Sciences Research Council, the Academy, other social formations, whether they're youth formations, civic organizations, labor organizations, need to shape this because the technology is not just the technology. The technology needs to be shaped by human needs. So to end off, both the Minister and the Deputy Minister, who I assisted in doing some briefing notes and then they presented at other forums, the key terminology that we would talk about is a human-centric fourth industrial revolution. How do we develop a human-centric fourth industrial revolution? And I think the conversations today will help to take us forward, and we look forward to working very closely with both our portfolio committee, and I see the Deputy Speaker has come, with Parliament as a whole, because even in that instance, the kind of coordination across different portfolio committees are going to become important to shape the regulatory and the governance system that will help to make sure that we don't only have an industrial revolution, but we have an industrial revolution that maximizes the positive value for human beings. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Imran. Imran Patel is a DTG from the Department of Science and Innovation. He did represent the minister very well, Imran. Thank you very much for your brief input. Welcome, Honorable Deputy Speaker. Your seat belongs here on the high table. So I'm going to ask you that you join us here so that we can be able to converse and see how we will also assist us with your knowledge of the fourth industrial revolution.
Sorry, Chairperson, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members. I go there on condition that this is not a strategy to silence me. I will not be silenced like I am when I'm in the House, so I'll come there on that condition.
Okay, no, you are never going to be silenced, not you. Nobody has got the capacity to silence you, as members know here. So what we will do, honorable members, is that we will take the three presentations and then focusing on the theme. So we've segmented, honorable deputy speaker, this colloquium into three sub-themes. So the first sub-theme, we're posing a question there, which we think that it will help us as part of the introduction to the subject, to say what is the fourth industrial revolution and how will it impact the science, technology and innovation and post-school education and training sectors. So that is the first sub-theme. So we've got three speakers who are going to help us to unpack or respond to this question. So we have got Dr. Fesser from the CSIR. I believe that he worked with Parliament before in hosting the round table. We've got Mr. Nimrod, the Deputy Director General from the Department of Trade and Industry, who's going to speak more from the trade perspective. Of course, you'll also talk to other aspects of what the Department of Trade and Industry is doing around this. And then we've got Mrs. Jeanette Morwane, who is the Chief Director in the Department of Communication and Digital Technologies. So the Presidential Commission that the President has put up, the Department of Communication and Digital Technologies are providing the Secretariat. So I believe Ms. Jeanette Morwane is the most appropriate person who's serving in the Secretariat to the Commission on the 4IR. So they will, the three of them will help us to understand the fourth industrial revolution as it is. So we did indicate that we've got a bit of time challenges. I don't know how long the presentation is going to be. So if we can try and stick to at least not longer than 30 minutes each. And then from there we'll give to the Honorable Deputy Speaker to also give some comments on that, and then we open for all of us to engage. Dr. Fesser?
Thank you, Chair. Is it okay if I stay here for the presentations, or would you prefer me there?
You can come this. Oh, are you going to do the slides?
I'm going to be doing the slides.
I think
slides as well.
you can do it from there.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you, Chair. Honourable Deputy Speaker, great to see you again. Honourable members, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again for giving me an opportunity to create awareness around Fourth Industrial Revolution. Today I'm tasked with giving a bit of an introduction and overview of what this Fourth Industrial Revolution thing is. And I do want to just go through a few things around, what is this beast that we call the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And then I'll go on to a few things around what we should be doing, the kind of things that we need to be implementing, building a little bit on what Imran put forward in his opening address and, in fact, what the Chair put forward in his opening address. And then I just want to close off with a few of the things that we are doing already as a country and the things that are moving forward. So as Imran pointed out, there are a lot of words flying around. There are a lot of ways that this revolution is being described, and we can question whether it is the fourth industrial revolution, whether it is in fact an industrial revolution, and whether it's a revolution at all. So far, luckily on the last point, we haven't had a true social revolution around this digital change. And I think that's what Imran was referring to, that as a society, we are trying to coordinate this a lot better so we do not get to that point of having a true social revolution around the technology change. So I'm going to go through a few of those points and we'll come to a bit of a conclusion at the end, confusing between computers. So as the chair mentioned, we've had what have been recognized as three industrial revolutions so far. And I'm not going to go into heavy detail around these revolutions. Each one was initiated by a particular technology change. The first one was steam, the second one was electricity, to some extent the combustion engine, and then the third revolution was around the microprocessor, around computers, effectively. But there are other trends that came with each of those revolutions. Through all of them, we had the rise of a new way of production. So in the first industrial revolution, you had the rise of the factory system. In the second industrial revolution, it was massive industrialization across a number of different sectors. In the third industrial revolution, we started seeing a lot more automation, a lot more digital technologies coming into play. And then we get into the fourth industrial revolution, which I'll talk to in a bit, which starts to see a building on all of those type of increases in production. Through all three of those revolutions, we then also saw an increase in connectedness between people, between geographic regions. Between the first and the second industrial revolution, we saw the rise of first the steam engine and then the electrical engine and railway systems. So you had better connection between cities and between people. Between the second and into the third industrial revolution, you had the telephone system coming into play, and then you had the internet, and then you had digital communication. So you saw a lot more interconnectedness. People could communicate a lot more, and you saw different types of industries developing alongside that interconnectedness. So you saw big global companies being formed and big global conglomerates being formed as you got more connectedness between people across the world, the sort of globalization effect. And in the fourth industrial revolution, this just gets massified. It gets increased. So is it really a distinct fourth industrial revolution? We tend to think so, but it can be argued that it is an extension of the third industrial revolution. But to be honest, all of them can be argued to be an extension of the previous revolution, so to speak. So the fourth industrial revolution, as Imran mentioned, is really this fusion between different aspects of life, between the physical aspects of life, between digital technologies, and between the biological space. And as we talk about the fourth industrial revolution, we often speak about digital, digital, digital. And as Imran mentioned, there's a lot more to it. And as I go through some of the technologies, you'll see that the digital plays a big role in the fourth industrial revolution, and it is a central dogma of all of the things that we are trying to do. But there are a number of other technologies that are building and evolving rather than just growing incrementally. So I'll go through a couple of those in a second. But again, building on the same trends from the previous three revolutions, we're seeing exponential growth. We're seeing ever more interconnectedness, increased human productivity. This revolution is not necessarily driven by productivity, but productivity will be a big part of it, and we will see increased productivity from advanced manufacturing technologies, from different ways of doing work. And the big thing that people are putting across is that we're seeing this blurring of lines between machines and humans. And I know that tends to scare people quite a lot, that we're starting to, you know, there isn't this huge distinction anymore, and particularly in robotics. But that can also be turned into an advantage, and that is the kind of planning that we need to do around this revolution. It's very important to note, though, Imran touched on the breadth and scope of the fourth industrial revolution and the speed. The truth is it's here already. I mean, everything around the fourth industrial revolution is already happening. It will also touch on nearly every sector of society. So from an industrial perspective, it really is going to touch on agriculture. It's going to touch on manufacturing. It's going to touch on fisheries. Everything that we can possibly think of, there's an aspect where technology can make those industries better, where technology can transform those industries. And we need to consider how to do this in a responsible manner. I've spoken already, does this point to work on you? Oh, it does. I've spoken already about the physical, the digital and the biological worlds. And from a technology point of view, we need to consider how we build our capabilities in those spaces, how we create a competitive advantage for the country in terms of capabilities in those spaces, or where we partner with certain countries to bring in those technologies. There's no reason why South Africa has to develop everything from the beginning. Already within South Africa, I've seen some amazing technologies produced from digital technologies through to advanced manufacturing technologies. But we don't have to reinvent everything. A lot of these things we can import and localize for our own conditions. From a business perspective, just business models themselves will change. If you consider Uber, if you consider Airbnb, if you consider Alibaba, all of these major companies at the moment that are not based on traditional business models. They're based on digital business models. They're based on digital sharing. So we have to look at how can we use those kind of business models in our own sense, and also how do we not fall behind things like globalization, things like decentralization, where parts are manufactured in different parts of the world and then assembled in yet another part of the world. How do we become part of those global value chains? And we have to make sure that we address those areas. The other area that happily I see discussed more and more and more, and in fact is becoming central to discussion, is around society. Imran touched on skills 4.0. There will need to be a whole new set of skills that are developed to address these new technologies and new ways of manufacturing. Connectedness. Yes, we are interconnected in such a big way, but what does that mean for our interpersonal relationships? What does that mean when it comes to one-on-one relationships? What does it mean when it comes to privacy? What does it mean when it comes to equality? There is a very good discussion at the moment which talks to, is this going to create more equality or less equality? Are we going to create more of a divide? Are we going to add in a digital divide between those that actually have access or can afford technology versus those that can't? And those things need to be considered very early on as we are implementing, and particularly from fora like this, where we look at legislation, where we look at policy, it's very important that we set the boundaries for how we implement technology and how we ensure that it is inclusive. Unfortunately, that's not coming up very clearly. I wanted to go through just a couple of technologies that are really driving the fourth industrial revolution. And you know, if we think about something like in the top left-hand corner there, advanced robotics. As I said, we're blurring the lines a little bit. Previously with robotics, it was a case of anything that a robot did was programmed by a human. Now we start getting advanced digital technologies, artificial intelligence, machine learning. Robots now have the ability to learn. They take in data, they can learn from an environment, and they can make a decision themselves based on that data. So that's where the advanced robotics come in. And robots aren't all these humanoid forms. They, you know, they're digital. They can be in the cloud. They can be on a computer. A robot is something that performs an action. So advanced robotics is going to necessarily make a huge difference in our lives. How it makes that difference, we're still not 100% sure, but we need to consider these things. If I look at things like big data and analytics, we are producing data at such a rapid rate. All of us right here in this room are producing data right now, through our cell phones, through recordings, through everything. How we interpret that data, how we analyze that data, the ability to analyze that data is getting better and better through big data analytics. And that then feeds into artificial intelligence, and it feeds into machine learning and things like that. An area that could be potentially huge for South Africa is simulation. So everything that we have, every production process, every product, will ultimately have a digital presence. It'll have a digital version and a physical version. And the thing around simulation is it really speeds up production time. So you won't necessarily need to do physical prototypes of a product. You can do a digital prototype. You can, in fact, do a digital prototype of the entire production process. So before you've invested significant cost in pilot facilities, you could have done the digital simulation already. And the other thing about having a digital simulation of an environment is if you then add in the next technology, augmented reality, you now have the ability to train on digital environments. So you can train people working with really big machinery in a digital environment instead of creating a safety hazard where they train then on that big piece of machinery. If you can imagine, for instance, other applications where you have a municipal worker with a simple iPad, if you've got a digital version of your entire water distribution center, that system, that person can walk around with an iPad and visualize pipes underground. And if you have the right sensors in place, they can then visualize a leak as well. So that's the kind of power that we can have with these digital technologies. And we must not actually consider how the digital technologies might drive our lives. We must consider how digital technologies can solve our issues. The same sort of thing goes for, I sort of put them into a broad category around digital integration, cloud computing, and the Internet of Things. So what this really is how do we connect all the sensors that we have? Each of you have phones at the moment. Those have a camera, they have a microphone, they have all sorts of things on them. Those are all sensors. How can we connect those sensors together to make lives better? How can we, for instance, connect all of the sensors in a city to be able to adequately visualize a city, make that city safer so we can pick things up faster, make sure we can respond to disasters, respond to fires, respond to floods in a rapid way? That's the Internet of Things. That's creating smart spaces, smart cities. And that is an extremely powerful tool, and I know we'll be looking at that soon. And then Imran did touch on advanced manufacturing, 3D printing, so to speak. 3D printing is a very rudimentary form of advanced manufacturing. There are so many aspects in advanced manufacturing. 3D printing is just one of them. Many of you will know about 3D printing with plastic. We're moving on to laser-based 3D printing with metal products at the moment. How can we create large aerospace components using 3D printing? But more than that, it's about advanced materials. How can we create much lighter components, much stronger components, or if necessary, more flexible components through 3D printing, but using advanced materials, so nanomaterials, alloys, new biological alloys, mixing biological with other materials. So there's a lot more that goes into advanced manufacturing than purely 3D printing, and all of it is backed by digital technologies. So there's a lot in that space. So that's FIAR in a nutshell, pretty quickly. But what should we be doing as a country? How should we be responding? One of the biggest areas, and I keep on touching this, and I know I've done a lot of work with the Deputy Speaker's office in this space, is around how can we create a conducive policy environment. I know that the Presidential Commission has been looking into different aspects of policy in the industrial space and in various other societal spaces, and have identified hundreds of policies that we need to reconsider, that we need to rework or get rid of completely because they are actually hindering our advancement as a country. And then there are a number of policies that are not there, particularly around how do we deal with data, how do we transfer data. If you consider something like digital trade, how do we transfer data across borders in such a way that it remains safe, in such a way that we are not taken advantage of? So we need to consider these policies and how they work, and not just policies internal, but how do we have policies that span borders, that span nations. The other area is around state support. This is going to be a big technological change. It's going to be a big societal change, and the state needs to be driving a lot of that change, but not just by itself. It needs to be driving it with the private sector. You cannot have just a state-driven initiative, and you cannot have just a private sector-driven initiative. The first three revolutions, unfortunately, predominantly saw private sector-driven. They were looking at profits, increased productivity, increased profits, and what you ended up with is society being left behind, and ultimately society then revolted. They came back. We don't want to see that in this revolution at all. So we want to have both driving together, state and private sector. And that's what I speak about on the public-private sector models at the, on the side, and I'll talk to one of those models in a little bit. The other area, as Imran did highlight, and the chair highlighted, is we need to increase investment in research and development. We cannot hope to advance as a country in a revolution that is based on innovation and technology without having a solid innovation and technology base ourselves. So what are we doing so far? I want to talk about just a couple of things, particularly driven by the Department of Science, not necessarily the areas because I know they will be brought up in the education space through some of the other speakers. The first is an area called a converging technologies platform that we are putting together. As Imran mentioned, we have invested over the last 10 to 15, sometimes 20 years, in a number of these technologies, and don't get me wrong, the technologies that we talk about in the fourth industrial revolution are not new. They have been there for a while. Digital technologies have been there for a while. Biotechnology, CSIR has been in biotechnology for 20 years. These are not new. They're evolving and they're integrating. The big area is the integration. So the Department of Science has invested in advanced materials, in nanotechnology, in new alloys, that have invested in microelectronics, in photonics, industrial biotechnology. So we've invested over the years in a number of areas where we've done capability development. So we've developed infrastructure, we've developed human resources, people that are really good in these spaces. What we need to do now, and this is where the Converging Technologies platform comes in, is coordinate the activities of those platforms, of that capability, so that we are creating solutions. So if we have a particular solution, if we're looking at a solution in the health space, how do we combine the work that we're doing in artificial intelligence, in data processing, and in biotechnology to improve health outcomes? So we will coordinate the activities of these platforms to create real solutions in different spaces. We'll also look at where do we need to further invest. So things like augmented reality, we haven't invested significantly in as a country. Cloud computing, we've started some programs, but we need to get more programs going. And do we then partner with the likes of Microsoft or Cisco to do significant cloud computing? There are a number of companies there. We really must not try to do this all by ourselves. The second area that I want to speak about that's happening right now, which is very exciting, and I know the Minister and the Director General of the Department of Science have made announcements of this centre over the last couple of weeks, particularly at WEF Africa. In early next year, we will be launching the World Economic Forum's Affiliate Centre for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. What this centre looks at is technology governance. It looks at these policy areas. It looks at the boundaries to the uptake and implementation of technologies that can make impact. So looking at policy frameworks, looking at governance frameworks. It doesn't look necessarily at development of a technology itself. But what we will do is we will pilot projects. So we will pilot a project in Internet of Things or in blockchain or in precision medicine. And as we're piloting the implementation of the technology, we will work around the technology governance. And we will create governance frameworks that can then be scaled for other projects. The other huge advantage of working in the center or having the center in South Africa is that you're globally connected. So where there are a number of projects happening all over the world, the primary centers at the moment are in San Francisco, China, India, and Japan. There are also then additional centers. The first two affiliate centers were in Colombia and the United Arab Emirates. We will now have another one launched in Israel in November, Norway in February, South Africa in March, and Australia early next year as well. The work done in those centers for their environments, we will have access to. So we can piggyback on other projects and adapt them for South African conditions in the same way that they will be looking to us for the particular nuances of our environment as well and how we put policy frameworks together and work in that. So through this center, we can really accelerate our adoption of technologies and advancement of technologies. And we have access to some of the best experts in the world, so we can really fast-pace our development in this space. Initially, we'll be looking, in all likelihood, at the areas of blockchain and distributed ledgers, so digital protection, effectively, and then also at Internet of Things, so the basis for smart cities. And how do we create smart environments, smart rural, peri-urban environments, and urban environments.
We're also looking to focus predominantly on the areas of health and mining. So health from the perspective of how do we use technology to support the implementation of national health insurance. There are so many things on the back of national health insurance that we need to get right before we can properly implement it. How do we have full patient data? How do we understand where we are having potential disease outbreaks, or if we are having a particular concentration of a particular problem in a certain area? The government is going to need to be able to plan for those things, and can we get that data in a way that we can plan effectively for those kind of things? In the mining space, we know a number of the issues in the mining space. Are we going to continue with the kind of productivity we have in the mining space? Can we improve that productivity without losing jobs? That is a very important aspect. So we will focus a lot of our attention in that space as well. As Imran mentioned, we already have the Mandela Mining Precinct that is looking at a number of these new technologies. Unfortunately, I did have a video, but good old technology. In any discussion that I have on Fourth Industrial Revolution, I have a technology issue. It's one of those things. It's the world saying technology isn't everything, so don't worry about it. One of the other, or the last area that I just want to end on now, is learning factories. So learning factories is a model that is being used across the world where you put together what is a mock factory system, but with digital technologies or new technologies. So it could be advanced manufacturing. It could be new types of materials that you're working with, digital integration. You could have different visualization methods. All of this also obviously with a digital environment on top of it. And the idea of putting these learning factories together is that they are teaching spaces. So the Department of Trade and Industry, the CSR, TVET colleges, and the CETAs have come together to put together what is a first learning factory for the country. And we will be starting the building of that learning factory early next year. And the idea is that we will then develop curricula around that, and you'll have hands-on training in the learning factory itself so that you can start developing the skills in this space. Okay, so that's those are the areas that I just wanted to highlight for today where we are starting to do a lot of work. Oh, yeah, there's the one more thing. Imran did talk about coordination, and it is extremely important that we get this coordination going. So today I've spoken about, there it is, the WEF Center, which looks at policy and governance and regulation. I've spoken about the Converging Technology Platform, which talks to the actual technology development itself. There are a number of other platforms that are under development at the moment. Jeanette will speak around the enabling environment, I'm pretty sure, with ITU, yeah, and working with International Telecommunications Union. And then there's a platform that we need to start looking at around inclusive development, which is really looking at all of these developments. How do we ensure that everybody has access to this technology? How do we ensure that everybody at least gets benefit from these technologies and these implementations? All four of these things need to have their own independence to be able to develop without boundaries, but they need to be interconnected as well. You can imagine a new technology. If you're trying to implement a new technology, you could get to a point where the technology is ready for implementation, but as a country, we don't have the right policy framework for the implementation, and you lose the potential impact of that technology. In the same way, you could have somebody that is looking to implement a technology without considering just the total inclusiveness of that technology. They're looking at it from a profit point of view, so to speak, a small gain point of view, from a societal point of view. And that's where we need the inclusive development to say, no, we have to consider further than just one company or one sector. And all of these need to interact. So you need to have the public and the private sector interaction, but you also need to have global interaction. And for us particularly is interaction further into Africa. I would like to see that South Africa leads the rest of Africa in our adoption of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and I think we do have the capability to do that. We also mentioned the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. That commission is doing a lot of the pre-work, a lot of the identifying what it is we need to do. But somebody's going to have to do that once that has been developed, once the strategy is in place. And that is what this collaborative platform is all about, is once we know what it is we want to do as a country, we're going to have to go out there and do it. And we're not waiting for the Presidential Commission to finish its great work, we've got to start putting these things in place. Otherwise, we're going to have a big pause and lose momentum in this space. Chair, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Fesser, for the presentation. I think it helps to ground us into understanding exactly what is the 4IR and what initiatives are there. So thanks for the, if you can just switch off the light, the mic. Thank you very much. We have now been joined by members of the portfolio committee. The remaining ones who were not here earlier on. We did present your apology, so you're welcome. We welcome all of you. Comrades, you're welcome. So we'll get a presentation from Nimrod from the Department of Trade and Industry. And then the last one will be from Communications and Digital Technology Department.
Thanks very much, Chair, and morning to honourable members. I think our input from the department is really placed in the context of the focus is on the industrial, in the fourth industrial revolution, and how we see that as absolutely fundamental to addressing South Africa's growth and developmental and development challenges. So we locate the emergence of the fourth industrial revolution within a much longer term process of structural transformation and catch up, in which developing countries that have managed to catch up with the income levels of developed countries have done so through this process of structural transformation, which involves shifting people from lower to higher value-adding activities. And historically, that process has happened through industrialization. And in fact, there are no examples, there are no cases of countries that have achieved high income levels without going through this process of industrialization. Now, we know that for a variety of reasons, including some of the technological changes that my colleague raised, that industrialization has become a more challenging process over the last few decades. But there are no countries that have been able to leapfrog this industrialization stage. And that is because manufacturing remains the main site of technological and skills acquisition in an economy, and also because it has unique linkages and multipliers to the rest of the economy. So, you know, we see manufacturing as the engine of the economy, driving the rest of the economy. And in the same vein that there have been no cases of successful catching up without industrialization, this has never happened automatically. So there have similarly been no cases of industrialization without well-designed and coherent industrial policies and the linking of those policies to other complementary policies such as technology and skills acquisition. So apologies, I think this graph is quite difficult to see on the on the board, but what this shows is that there's a very clear positive relationship between the rate of growth of manufacturing across a wide range of developing economies and the rate of growth of the economy as a whole. And we can see similarly that there's also a significant correlation between the rate of growth of manufacturing and the rate of growth of formal employment in this group of developing and transition economies. I think my CSIR colleague has traced the kind of history of the first through to the fourth industrial revolution, so I'm not going to dwell on that. But what I would like to highlight is that that we see, and I think there are a number of observers that are saying that at the core of much, not all of the fourth industrial revolution, but of much of this process is increasing digitalization and the emergence of data as this new kind of primary resource. So data, you know, so whereas in the past, you know, minerals, you know, were seen as the, you know, the primary resource. The new primary resource, primary economic resource, is the data that is generated by citizens of countries. And we're seeing side by side with that the increasing digitalization of production and distribution in the economy, and that suggests that we need to respond to this increasing digitalization and increasing importance of data in our policy, in securing our policy space and in formulating appropriate policy responses. To turn briefly to how this is impacting the manufacturing sector in particular, what we observe, and this is spelt out, incidentally, Chair, in the there's a complementary paper that we have circulated, Digital Industrial Policy Issues paper, which has been produced by the Industrial Development Think Tank at the University of Johannesburg, which is supported by the Department of Trade and Industry. And their analysis is that that the particular set of capabilities that we need to increasingly acquire in the manufacturing sector in order to be able to compete in this new, more digitalized economy, and that firms that are competitive, manufacturing firms that are competitive, have already begun to integrate these technologies. Many of these technologies are not they are not so far out of reach that they cannot be acquired by South African manufacturing firms. A lot of it is part of their incremental kind of upgrading as they have engaged in this incremental upgrading, so they have already begun to acquire these kinds of capabilities. But the kinds of capabilities that we're seeing as essential to roll out and to have manufacturing firms adopt across the board include digitalization and integration of their supply chains, and that means increasing increasing digital linkages between producers and purchasers. So, for one example, in the clothing sector, is the Clothing Textiles Competitiveness Program has helped link up manufacturers to local retailers, the IT system, so that when retailers are running low on stock of a particular product, there's a kind of close integration with manufacturers, and we think that kind of supporting those kinds of technologies has helped in turning around the fortunes of the clothing sector, in beginning to stabilize employment levels in the clothing sector. What's also becoming increasingly important is the use of monitoring in the production process itself. So on the shop floor, when machines are running, increasingly digital monitoring of the production process in order to optimize the production process. The the ability to design products and prototype them, develop prototypes quite quickly and bring them into production. This is a very important capability that needs to be acquired. And again, as my colleague was saying, the use of 3D printing is already well established in this space. You know, this is not new. It's developing in new ways. And I think we see for the foreseeable future, for mass production, 3D printing is going to be very important for that kind of prototyping, to develop the mold, the first product that you produce, to get it into mass production. It's going to take significantly more time before I think we see ourselves in a space where you're going to have mass production of products through the process of 3D printing. At the moment, it's really it's in niche areas, very kind of selected areas in aerospace or related to automotive components or medical applications. Advanced manufacturing and automation, again, this is linked to the increasing digitalization of the production process. And then lastly, what is incredibly important is to pay increasing attention to the role of e-commerce and sales through e-commerce platforms and the role of online activity, the way in which consumers increasingly find products through online search functions and through social media platforms. And here there's both an opportunity, but there are also some pitfalls which we need to be aware of. So online platforms can open up routes for consumers. It can open up possibilities for smaller and medium enterprises to supply to larger markets. But one of the difficulties that we have, and this is actually a global difficulty not unique to South Africa, is that there's a set of what are called super platforms that have come to dominate the space, and I think we're all aware of the companies, and they're largely US and Chinese global super platforms. So we're talking about Google, Amazon, Alibaba, and so forth. And so paying attention to competition and regulatory issues are going to be very important in that space. There are three policy principles that we suggest should be taken into account as we work with our colleagues at Department of Communications and Technology as they lead this process under the 4IR Commission. And that is understanding that digital industrialization, they're both incremental changes and disruptive technologies. So there are a number of areas where change is not happening, at a kind of exponential rate, where the challenge is rather the incremental upgrading to remain competitive, but also that there are some specific areas where there are, you know, big disruptive technological changes. And there will also be tipping points where some of these things shift to becoming entirely disruptive. So one example I think that is very important for South Africa to take into consideration is the shift to electric vehicles and away from internal combustion engine vehicles. You know, at some point these vehicles are going to become the predominant vehicle, and this has massive implications both for our mining sector, because for platinum group metals and other minerals, but also for our automotive sector. Digital industrialization must create the conditions for more domestic value creation and distribution, rather than simply facilitating the importation of products and technologies elsewhere. We've got to be producers within the system. And thirdly, that the technological change is driving systemic change through the economy, and that calls for a systemic and integrated policy response across a wide range of policy fronts. So from trade, regulation, competition, taxation, industrial technology, skills and infrastructure policy. These need to be integrated. Turning then to some of the, more specifically some of the policy areas that we need to take into account. Let's start with the kind of international trade negotiation space. It is very important that we pay close attention to and engage in the emerging global set of trade rules that are going to govern the digital economy going forward. And these engagements are happening at the global level, regional, and through bilateral negotiations. One of the very big processes that is happening globally is what's called a plurilateral process on e-commerce rules, which has been driven primarily by the United States, and it's a process kind of parallel to the World Trade Organization's normal trade negotiations process. And what it is seeking to do is to create a critical mass, get a critical mass of countries, particularly developing countries, to sign up to rules which will restrict national policy space to respond to new technologies and to respond to increasing digitalization. So the U.S. Has developed a set of rules that they would like to see govern the space, which they call the Digital Two Dozen. And broadly speaking, what that seeks is for countries to sign up to essentially allowing unrestricted digital transactions. So, and that means things like no taxation of digital transactions between countries. It includes things like no localization requirements, no domestic policy considerations. And I think we need to really remain alive to what the pitfalls would be if we were to developing countries as a whole would sign up to these rules uncritically. and broadly speaking, and again, I think it was also touched on by Imran, I think what we're seeing, one way in which the China-US trade kind of dispute is being characterized is that ultimately it's about who gains mastery over these new fourth industrial revolution technologies. And the view that's emerging on the trade front is that South Africa, amongst other developing economies, should not be choosing between one master or other in this global system, but rather that developing countries need a developmental set of rules that give them the policy space to respond. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is that the decisions that are made now and commitments that are made now are going to have consequences for how we are able to respond both to current technological changes but future technological changes which we may not even be able to anticipate right now. Secondly, and this to some extent flows from the policy space theme, there are a number of issues around taxation. As the digital economy unfolds, the issues of taxation shift no longer just to physical goods or goods and services that are not traded online, to what's the appropriate taxation regime for goods and services that are bought and sold on online platforms. This goes to our fiscal integrity and our fiscal base in a context where a number of global super platforms use very aggressive kind of taxation planning techniques, let's say, with a lot of the profits shifted to low tax jurisdictions. So this is an area that we need to confront from a taxation point of view. There are also a set of issues around competition and appropriate regulation in this space. So again, in a context where you have these global super platforms, what you observe is what's called a winner-takes-most market outcomes. So it's very difficult to build an alternative search engine to Google, or to build on a similar scale an online retail offering such as Amazon's. These are global oligopolies or monopolies, which in turn call for regulatory and competition responses. And I think the important lessons that we can learn from how other jurisdictions are beginning to respond to this issue, I think we've seen in many ways the European Union has been amongst the forefront of responding on the competition front. It's implemented a number of competition investigations into large digital platforms. France, for instance, has introduced a kind of digital transaction tax. But we're also seeing policy responses emerging from other developing countries. China itself having developed large platforms behind what's sometimes called the great firewall of China, is perhaps somewhat similarly to the US, is seeking a fairly liberal kind of global regime, but countries like India and Indonesia are responding with digital policy frameworks, and on the continent, Rwanda has also been one of the countries that has developed a policy framework that begins to set out, these are the kinds of activities that we want to see taking place domestically. The way in which digital infrastructure is rolled out is going to be tremendously important. As we see the rollout of 5G networks, we need to ensure that the regulatory framework in which that happens is competitive, it delivers affordable data to consumers and businesses in South Africa. There are also a lot of scope in the way in which digitalization can be brought to bear to help solve some of our difficulties in areas of traditional infrastructure. So, for instance, if one looks at energy, there's a lot of kind of digital technologies that are being emerged for smart grid systems that enable much larger renewable energy within a country. There's significant scope to look at how government and public services can be rendered more effective through the use of technological platforms. And there's also areas in which we can use technology applications around climate change, weather monitoring, water efficiency, and very importantly, agricultural modernization, in which a couple of hundred thousand jobs could be created in modernizing our agricultural sector. Then we need to support the acquisition by firms and by sectors of digital industrial capabilities. As I've said, this is increasingly part of their industrial upgrading journey, the acquisition of these capabilities. But I think we need to think more particularly about how do we scale up and also adapt financing instruments for firms to acquire these kinds of capabilities. So that, aside from expanding the financing instruments available, we need to think about how industrial financing instruments are broadened. So historically, industrial financing would have helped a company acquire, you know, a building, a set of machinery, but we need to be able to support acquisition of these supply chain tools that we've of the kind of ICT tools in addition to machinery. We need to look at how we better support innovation and commercialization. So the kinds of things that the CSIR is doing, you know, developing potentially commercializable, if that's the word, it's probably not, technologies. You know, how do we take it from the, you know, from the you know, kind of building in the CSIR, some prototype or pilot, and commercialize that technology in South Africa rather than licensing it abroad, which is often what has happened with locally developed technology. And then more broadly supporting research and development. Of particular significance to this committee are the kinds of skill sets that the higher education system needs to deliver, and the work that's been done to date suggests, you know, these are some quite specific types of skills that we need to be supporting in order to remain relevant in an increasingly digitalized economy. So things like software engineering, data science, related ICT skills, computer-aided design, manufacturing, enterprise resource planning, materials requirements planning, manufacturing execution planning. Sector-specific digital skills, there needs to be a much stronger integration between the needs of industry and the CETAs around identifying, updating curricula and rolling out these skills, and that also involves a similar process for the vocational education and training institutions. Another important skill set that I think is going to become increasingly important is the ability to do big data analysis. So, you know, even for a manufacturing firm, we've seen examples, for instance, you know, firms have gone and done big data and analytic kind of exercises where they say, what are the products that people are searching for on a site like Amazon that they can't find? And can we produce those products? You know, how do we analyze, you know, how do we analyze the information that we have from our customers that is coming to us from apps, from, you know, from various sources to refine what we produce, what we manufacture? The state itself needs to begin to acquire new skill sets around regulation and competition, trade negotiations, industrial technology innovation and skills policy, big data analysis for public policy. How can we use big data analysis to solve social problems, very pressing social problems that we have, and e-government? And then, of course, our basic education system needs to, you know, increasingly be equipping learners to enter this shifting economic space, and that necessarily implies, you know, again, a stronger emphasis on numeracy, math and science, and developing science, technology, engineering, and math skills. Thanks, Chair and Honourable Members. That brings me to the end of the presentation.
Okay, thank you very much, Nimrod. Thank you for your presentation, very enlightening. The possibilities in trade and industry, manufacturing, yeah, so there's still a lot to be learned around this 4IR and manufacturing. Later on, COSAT will come and talk to us about the reskilling. so that it can be relevant to the demands of the 4IR. Okay, we are now going to take Ms. Jeanette Murwane, the Chief Director from the Department of Communication and Digital Technologies. Over to you, ma'am. Maybe you are going to even tell us the move from communication and technology to communication and digital technologies. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair, honorable members, colleagues. Yes, I'm from the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies, where there has been a reconfiguration of two departments, the Department of Communications as well as Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services. We are currently undergoing a reconfiguration process. So up until March, we're still sort of operating as two separate departments but sharing a ministry in terms of our minister and deputy minister. And we have been also assigned with the responsibility to facilitate and coordinate government program on the fourth industrial revolution, mainly coordinating the work of the presidential commission on the fourth industrial revolution. So I'm just going to present on sort of the fourth industrial revolution, the context, but also some of the thinking within government around the fourth industrial revolution, and also give sort of an update of where we are with regards to the commission and also what we are doing as a department in terms of the fourth industrial revolution, and with a key focus of how we align with the higher education and science and technology. So when we started sort of looking at the issues of the fourth industrial revolution, the first thing we went back to was to look at sort of what is the role of the state in the economy, because the fourth industrial revolution is sort of an era that is disrupting both economic and social aspects and mainly driven by technological advancement. And this is taken mainly from the NDP, but also some of the work that was done by the economic and employment cluster, looking at reviewing the industrial policy, where we were looking at what does it mean to be a state, so that when we start identifying sort of opportunities and leveraging sort of benefits from the fourth industrial revolution, we do that with an understanding of who we are as a state. So the NDP as a state provides institutions and infrastructure that enable the economy and society to operate. Its ability to carry out this function has a profound impact on the lives of all South Africans, and this means that a state is an enabler, so it means it provides basic services and critical infrastructure. Secondly, it's a regulator. It sets rules that create equitable opportunities for all players. And thirdly, it's a redistributor, ensuring that most vulnerable in society are protected and given a chance to live up to their full potential. But most importantly, we recognize that as a state, we cannot operate alone, especially in this fourth industrial revolution paradigm. We must find ways to leverage strengths of private sector and civil society. Hence, when we established the Presidential Commission, we made sure that representatives of that commission are representing different sectors of society, whether it's private sector, it's academia, it's research, etc. So that was the first thing that we did, and also some of the work from the reimagined industrial policy outlined that
critical conditions for growth for the country to leverage economic growth and industrial revolution, industrialization, they can only be successful if we pay attention to the following issues. Firstly, reliable and cost-effective energy supply and distribution. Secondly, reliable and cost-effective water supply and reticulation. Access to rail network and reducing rail and port costs for national priority sectors. And then lastly, allocation of broadband spectrum, because for us to leverage advances in the fourth industrial revolution, we require broadband and connectivity. So with regards to the fourth industrial revolution, I think my colleagues have done good work in terms of unpacking what it is and how it evolved. But mainly in sort of basic terms, the fourth industrial revolution is mainly the convergence of three worlds, the cyber world, the physical world, and the biological world. And in that conversion, there is a disruption that happens, and what's important now is for governments to identify opportunities for economic growth, but also identify risks and identify sort of measures of how they are going to mitigate those risks. Some of the risks that have been identified by some of the papers that have been written by the World Economic Forum and other papers sort of indicate that this fourth industrial revolution is posing a threat in terms of, area of job losses. So governments and countries have to now come up with strategies on how to mitigate those risks as they develop their policies and also programs. And this slide just outlines some of the key technologies that are driving the fourth industrial revolution, and I think Daniel from the CSIR has unpacked most of these technologies. In the cyber world, you find the artificial intelligence and machine learning, blockchain, quantum computing. In the physical world, you have your 3D printing for manufacturing, robotics. There's also the issue of drones that are sort of emerging in the country, where we find ourselves having these technologies and we don't have legislation and regulation. People are driving these drones without licenses, and they are posing a risk. It can be a cyber risk. We've had a situation in the inauguration of the France president, where there was a threat to his life using a drone. So we need to start thinking of around these issues as a country. On the biological end, there's biomedical engineering and the issues of genomics. So those are some of the key technologies. And the report from the World Economic Forum has identified some of the impacts that the fourth industrial revolution is posing. And the key ones is stating that new technologies and platforms are increasingly enabling citizens to engage with governments, to voice their opinions, coordinate their efforts, and even circumvent supervision of public authorities. And some of this we see through the use of social media, where citizens are able to voice their opinions and create sort of disruptions through social media. The other aspect is that governments will increasingly face pressure to change their current approach to public engagement and policy making. The third one is that legislators and regulators must continuously adapt to new and fast-changing environments, and they need to reinvent themselves so that they can truly understand what it is that they are regulating. The most important one is that governments and regulatory agencies need to collaborate closely with business and civil society. And lastly, governments will not be able to address the emergence of digital economy in isolation, but must build and develop capacity to drive the process robustly. I think my colleague from DTI has mentioned that as government as well, we need to relook at the skills within government, you know, developing some of the key skills so that we are able to adapt to the advances of the fourth industrial revolution. And as we were sort of drafting the terms of reference of the commission, we had to look at some of the key studies and sort of look at how to guide the work of the commission. And some of the key studies or reports that we found was the World Economic Forum report on countries' readiness for future production opportunities. I think the DTI is assisting the country in terms of consolidating the South African data and submitting it to WEF. And the report is mainly indicating that as a country in terms of manufacturing, we are not doing well. Our manufacturing share of GDP has decreased to about 12% since the early 1990s. Although in the continent, we still have the strongest structure of production. And the positives are that the country has the ability to innovate with a strong innovation culture, especially in entrepreneurial activities supported by sophisticated financial sector. The other aspect on the negative is that in terms of human capital, it still remains as a most pressing challenge with a shortage of engineers, scientists, and digital skills. And on the positive is that as government we have stable policy environment, but we need to improve institutional frameworks on how to respond to change. So the key issue is that we have a very good policy environment. The challenge is more around coordination and avoiding issues of duplications and government departments wanting to control their space. If we want to adapt to change, we need to collaborate more as government departments so that we can make more impact. The other aspect was a report from Accenture looking at the future of work, focusing on employment, and it's sort of painting sort of a gloomy picture that we already know that in terms of demographics, 50% of the population is under the age of 30, and most of these youth are unemployed, and also the economy remains weak. So we need to then look at the fourth industrial revolution to say, what is it that we can leverage from the fourth industrial revolution to change this picture for the country. So in terms of the presidential commission on the fourth industrial revolution, it was first announced by the president. I think South Africa is one of the key countries that have taken championship in terms of at the leadership level to drive issues of the fourth industrial revolution from a government perspective. A similar sort of structure was set up by South Korea, where they've also set up a presidential committee on the fourth industrial revolution. And mainly what the president is saying is that in terms of the first, second, and third revolution, South Africa was more of a spectator, but with the fourth industrial revolution, we must take an active role and look at coming up with a country strategy that will assist the country to leapfrog into the fourth industrial revolution and improve our economy as well as social aspects. So with regards to the main deliverable for the commission, the commission is made up of 33 members
representative of different sectors, as I mentioned, and their main deliverable is to develop an integrated country strategy on the fourth industrial revolution. And that strategy must look at key aspects. The first aspect is an aspect of advising government on technology research and development program to advance the fourth industrial revolution. Mainly saying which of these fourth industrial revolution technologies that if we identify and invest in can assist the country to be globally competitive, both from an economic as well as a social perspective. Secondly, they must advise, the strategy must advise on key strategies and interventions for skills development and the future of work. As I mentioned, one of the key things is around job losses. So how do we then prepare our youth, our citizens, in terms of preparing them with digital skills, but also with those skills of the future that if they invest in, they'll then be able to participate in the fourth industrial revolution. The other aspect is making recommendations on enabling relevant infrastructure for South Africa to participate in the digital economy. The other aspect is to make recommendations on institutional frameworks and mechanisms to coordinate 4IR programs, especially issues around how do we develop good models around public-private partnerships that will make good impact. To also make recommendations on approaches to address inclusivity and the digital divide. Although the fourth industrial revolution is in our midst, we still have a digital divide where you still have rural areas that do not have proper, connectivity, where you are not even able to get, 3G connectivity, etc. So how, what approaches should we focus on to address this issue of inclusivity? Then the other aspect is around making recommendations on interventions to enable innovation and entrepreneurship and for SMMEs to take advantage of the fourth industrial revolution. Most studies have shown that countries that have invested in building a culture of entrepreneurship and investing in their SMMEs have been able to leverage economic growth. So this strategy must sort of make indications of those interventions that we can focus on around entrepreneurship and innovation. Then also look at advising on strategies to mobilize resources to support the fourth industrial revolution interventions. My colleagues from Department of Science and Innovation have mentioned that there's a need to invest more in R&D, so we need to look at strategies on how to mobilize resources so that we can increase spend in R&D. And then lastly, to make recommendations on mechanisms to measure the impact of interventions on 4IR. At some stage, once we start implementing these interventions, we need to measure them to say, when we started in 2017, this was the picture and this is how things have changed and this is what has contributed to that change. So we need to look at coming up with indicators to measure the fourth industrial revolution implementation in the country. So in sort of taking up this task, the commission then met and they sort of looked at their different expertise and they also looked at the task at hand and they've decided to set up work streams to assist them to come up with this country strategy. And the work streams, initially they had six work streams, but lately they've realized that there was a need to add two more work streams in terms of the work at hand. With regards to the work streams, and the work streams are sort of going to be sort of the core pillars of the country strategy. The first one is looking at infrastructure and resources, and infrastructure is not only limited to just digital infrastructure. They are also looking at, infrastructure around energy. How do we improve
the area of energy, how do we look at the right kind of infrastructure required for service delivery, so infrastructure around water, waste management, etc. But most importantly, also looking at how do we then resource, look at the resources required for making sure that we have that kind of right infrastructure. And then the second work stream is looking at science, technology, and innovation, where they're going to come up with sort of a blueprint around the areas that needs to be attended to with regards to science, technology, and innovation, the identified sort of technologies that we should invest in, but also looking at what is required. Do we need to look at our intellectual property rights, legislations, you know, incentives required to promote science, technology, and innovation in the country? So each work stream will develop its own blueprint, and then in the end, they will then look at those different blueprints and integrate that into a country strategy. The third work stream is the economic and social impact on the fourth industrial revolution. This looks mainly at you know, the economic impact and the social impact from the fourth industrial revolution. The fourth one looks at human capital and the future of work. It looks at the issues of skills development and the types of skills required for operating in the fourth industrial revolution. The fifth one looks at industrialization and commercialization, looking at the overall industrial value chain and identifying opportunities to leverage for the country. And then the sixth one is policy and legislation. What the Commission is saying is that for us to really leverage from this industrial revolution, we need to look at the different laws and identify where technologies are making an impact, and identify legislations and laws that needs to be changed, and if there are new laws that needs to be put in place, identify those laws so that government can start looking at those. An example would be on the issues of drones, for example, looking at, you know, the Transport Act and it being reviewed so that it accommodates the use of drones for economic and social purposes. And that's just but one example. And then the two additional work streams that have been added is the capital investment work stream that's mainly looking at issues of investments, how we can put in place the right kind of incentives and investments to support the fourth industrial revolution. And then the last work stream that has been introduced is the program integration work stream. This is mainly a team of commissioners looking at what the different work streams are doing and looking at areas of alignment and see how they can proper coordinate so that the different work streams don't duplicate in terms of when they come with their different blueprints. With regards to the time frame, so since April when the commission was appointed, they have been conducting research in their different work streams and sort of engaging with selected stakeholders just to test some of their ideas. So by the end of October, which is next month, they are expected to produce their first draft country strategy on 4IR, and after they've presented the draft country strategy, they will then embark on broader stakeholder consultations across the country, and the main sort of draft or the main sort of first country strategy that will be submitted to the president and cabinet will be in the end of January 2020, made a mistake there, And the main reason why they'll be submitting that in end of January is to make sure that whatever recommendations that they are putting in place will then be accommodated in the planning of government in terms of the, you know, the state of the nation address, but also in the different departments identifying key issues aligned to their areas of work and then integrating them into their plans for the next financial year. So that is the current sort of status around the work of the commission. In terms of what we are doing as a department with regards to the fourth industrial revolution, the first initiative that we have is the Digital Transformation Center that we have conceptualized and partnered with the International Telecommunications Union, ITU, as part of a legacy project for hosting the ITU World Telecoms Conference last year in September in Durban. And the idea with the center is to sort of create a center that will create an enabling ecosystem for public-private partnerships around issues of digital economy, and it's got four pillars. The first one will be looking at policy and governance around issues of digital economy. We've identified that as a country we have a gap in terms of a data policy or strategy where we need to give guidance in terms of how we manage data as a country, that we manage data as a government. The other areas we've identified is around the need to develop an artificial intelligence strategy, cloud policy, also areas of blockchain. And we will be working with the ITU, and also this aspect also aligns with the center that is being set up by the Department of Science and Innovation with the World Economic Forum to say we need to develop evidence-based policy that could assist us in advancing on the issues of the fourth industrial revolution. Then the second pillar of the center focuses on the issue of innovation and entrepreneurship, where we're looking at how can we create an enabling environment for innovation and entrepreneurship, and we actually conducted a study with the ITU where we looked at the South African digital innovation profile. And we worked with a whole lot of incubators and innovation hubs around this aspect. And this this aspect also looks at identifying sort of interventions that we need to put in place for enabling innovation and entrepreneurship. The third aspect is around infrastructure, looking at you know, making sure that we have the basics in place for us to participate in the fourth industrial revolution, and one area is around connectivity. Our department has been driving the South Africa Connect, which is the broadband policy, the implementation thereof, but we now need to look at, you know, accelerating that, and the department has made strides in terms of the issue of spectrum management. And also we this aspect also look at issues around how do we expand from 4G to 5G and leverage on 4IR technologies like the Internet of Things. And one area that we're looking at is the issue around developing, how do we develop smart cities, looking at developing a national framework for smart cities, looking at issues of standardizations and cyber security. Then the fourth aspect is around the issue of social impact, looking at issues of skills. Currently, the department has developed a digital skills strategy that I will present on in the next slide, and also look at how do we create partnerships with industry on digital skills development program to capacitate our citizens in terms of issues of digital literacy and digital skills and address issues of inequality and also bridging the digital divide. think, yes. So in terms of the digital skills strategy, we have worked in terms of the strategy, and the strategy has gone through the different government clusters, and it will be coming to cabinet towards the end of the year. And the main idea with the strategy is to say, how do we develop the right kind of skills for our citizens to participate in the fourth industrial revolution? And at the core of the strategy is that we are looking at four aspects, where we are looking at skills for digital foundations, where we are looking at basic education to say what kind of skills do we need to integrate into our basic education curriculum so that even children as they are growing, they sort of develop those skills as part of the curriculum, and we are working with the Department of Basic Education. The second aspect is around the digital futures and masters, where we're looking at advanced digital skills, and there we've been engaging with the Department of Higher Education, Science and Technology, and universities in terms of how can we then start looking at curriculum at an advanced stage. The third aspect is skills for industry and the world of work, identifying skills required for the world of work. And then the last aspect is about creating skills for society, making sure that citizens are able to use these technologies that are being introduced to them. And at the core of the strategy is that the strategy doesn't sort of outline a plan, but it has identified what we call job descriptors. So these are more descriptors of jobs of the future, but aligned to key technologies of the fourth industrial revolution. For example, with regards to artificial intelligence, the strategy then outlines the kind of job descriptors required for artificial intelligence, also for big data, for cybersecurity, etc. And this is to say then that now stakeholders, whether it's other government departments, it's industry, can then take these job descriptors and start developing curriculum or courses in line with this job descriptors. And then in closing, just to emphasize that for the Presidential Commission, the key thing is for them to advise government on what we need to do as a country to leverage advances on the fourth industrial revolution, and this will come out from the strategy. And we've looked at what most countries are doing. Countries are sort of, you know, prioritizing key areas of focus and putting all efforts into that. I think the challenge that we normally face in South Africa is that we always want to, for example, use or take the fourth industrial revolution to address all of our problems instead of, you know, prioritizing an area and putting all efforts on it so that we can make a greater impact. So that's it from my side. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. That was quite a mouthful and a bit of information overload. So I hope that we are all ready to engage with the presentation. So. We relax the rules a bit. It's not going to be only members, so we can engage all of us here as participants. We are running not a bit, but seriously behind schedule. So we will allocate 45 minutes for engagement after the input of the deputy speaker, if you want to engage or just give us the overall submission from yourself, and then we will open for everybody, of course prioritizing members first.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I really appreciate this opportunity to say one or two words. Please don't declare me illiterate when I go beyond the limit of one or two words. In a fit of irritation, the president of a country I'm visiting the next couple of weeks says, look, it's only in the hereafter where lambs will sit in the lap of lions. In the here and now, lions eat lambs. So those lambs won't survive today in the lap of a lion. They are going to be eaten. Context matters. And I like what has been said here in a couple of comments that have been made, that these developments are taking place in a context of huge inequalities. We have often used three words to describe our central problems in our country: poverty, inequality, and unemployment. And the reality that others, both in our own country and elsewhere, are dominant in the systems they support, both financially and otherwise, and in the rules they want to put into place in order to advance their interests. So in a previous discussion of this area, we were told as MPs we must be mindful of ethics, of the practices that are already emerging in this environment, but also the regulatory environment. What kind of legislation are we going to need? And the speaker identified three. The Americans, no regulation, if at all, or light touch necessarily. The Europeans, who focus, as one of the speakers said earlier on here, they are dead concerned about data, including personal data, its abuse and so on, so would want that to be regulated. And then he suggests that ours is likely to be in the area of developmental. So they are very specific developing country approach to legislation that is likely to be more developmental and, for example, protective of what we want to do because of our specific conditions, that we must reject any imposition of confining us to certain things and not to others, given our developmental status in the world. Industrialization as an example. What others did, the speaker says, from trade and industry, there was never a country that really developed without industrialization. The phrase that is often used is that they now want to kick the ladder. Now that they're upstairs, they don't want us to create a similar thing and go up the ladder as well. So for us, industrialization is that route, and we must do everything in our power that what we are doing is consistent with the conditions or that we want to undo inequality, unemployment, and poverty. So that, and I think some of the language we've used do refer to making sure that we do not only support efforts for those who want to make money. Our efforts must be aimed largely at the majority who want to make a living. And so that should be that. I wanted to suggest that, and as a result, there are discontinuities, but there are continuities as well. We have had a seminar to try and think about what we are doing as Parliament. In May last year, and the report you have in front of you summarizes in some way that issue. What that report doesn't say, there are two other reports that ought to have come. One was, which we will share with people here, we'll give it to the research team of the committee, the chair, with his... hopefully will help us distribute that, in which the name, there was an interesting debate about what this phenomena is. Is it the fourth industrial revolution? Is it the deepening of digital revolution, so to speak, and so on? And I would like us to, the apparent, in quotes, emerging consensus of calling it the fourth industrial revolution. Whilst it can be useful for purposes of a shorthand, but we must not allow it to conceal other phenomena that is taking place below what is emerging
as the so-called fourth industrial revolution. So we must be absolutely alert to those conditions. I would like to suggest also that the work that the committee is doing in this meeting probably is relevant to all the committees in the cluster in which it belongs, firstly. So you require a cluster approach, but also this cluster, like the others, this would likely be the economic cluster. So, this is where I'm going to, that it straddles both the economic cluster as well as the social transformation cluster and the governance cluster in some of the comments that have been made of developments that are taking place. And you've got the fourth other cluster and so on. So I wanted to suggest that even as we look at this, let's take a systematic thinking approach that recognizes the interconnectedness of the work we are doing here and always ask, who else are we leaving out in considerations that we are making? In what way are they impacted upon about the work we are doing here? So that we bring out and tease out those important connections that require us to produce better answers. And finally, maybe, so to speak, the reconfiguration of departments and consequently portfolio committees offers us also a useful opportunity to look at the connections that actually have. How is the use and deployment of technologies going to affect the work that we are doing? How can we impact on how we work across this previously divided but now together so that we advance integration quicker and faster, including with other departments that we want to collaborate? I thought it offers us an opportunity. I do want to end on finance, sorry. The deployment of our resources, public resources, is an important consideration that we must have, because the speaker from communications mentioned three roles of the state. I think she left out the fourth one. There are possibly other roles that she hasn't spoken to. Finance, in other words, the research and development, which refers to, incidentally, this is a critical role of the state. What it uses, its enormous resources it commands, but those that it can source from elsewhere to impact on this work. And that's an important role that the Chinese that some of you spoke about use. They say, yes, there are roles that must be, that people in their various organizations and formation can play. The state plays a guiding role in some of those things. There's no question about it. In this area, the internet grew out of public resources. The research to the military, and therefore Steve Jobs used that as a foundation for the creativity that he then used to produce the iPhones and MacBooks that you now use with abundance. So the public resources are critical, and how they are used and deployed to solve the problems we are dealing with here is an important one. Among the skills, ma'am, can you please include creativity? So we do talk about innovation, but deliberate creativity that stands on four pillars, clarifying the problem we are dealing with, ideating, producing a lot more ideas around it, developing those ideas and implementing them. Four pillars of creativity, which thankfully applies across the board, not only in the economic, but across the board, and in the education environment will be the source of our ability to respond appropriately so that we are not dependent. When we deliberately build on skills of creativity, and which often also lies from use of humanities, not only STEM subject. They must be both resourced, because it is only when they work together, humanities and STEM subject, that we will have better answers to the questions we are trying to solve here. Thank you very much for what is an interesting seminar, colloquium this morning, but I would like to request the chairperson and his team to provide you with information of what has already happened here, so that in talking about the work Parliament is doing, you refer to those things. It is amazing how I've discovered, even if it's in our YouTube channel, it's in our written reports, but sometimes
because of what you said, Chairperson, information overload. People who should know about it don't know about it. So it's there. Please go search that those sources for that report. But we'll make them available, including links to it, so that you can, at your leisure, go and look at what has already been done already and how we can link it on the work that is happening. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Speaker. We have distributed the report, is this one, of the work that already has been done by Parliament and through your office. So
it's one-fifth of what has been done, sir.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that right. May. We had an expo, we had a speakers forum in November, we had an expo at the post-SONA, and we had the other things that happened after then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I just thought I should point it out. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's why we asked that we should also do this thing with your office so that we can benefit from the work that has already been done on this 4IR through Parliament. Of course, we didn't have enough time. Ideally, we should be having this thing in 2 days. As you can see, the program is quite congested, but this is our last week here in Parliament, so we are rising on Friday. So we'll find another time. I think the proposal that we are making, I think it's in order, Deputy Speaker, that we must approach this thing as a cluster. So meaning those portfolio committees which conduct oversight over the departments that participate in the presidential commission, we should find a way of clustering ourselves and making a follow-up engagement on this particular subject. I think probably when some of the reports are beginning to emerge there, we might do a cluster approach and seek to engage with this thing as all the portfolio committees. I think that one is in order. Members, I'm sure you have been noting and itching to engage with the presentation, so the time is open. Because today we don't have enough time, so I'm really going to ask and plead and urge and do everything else possible to ask that we should try to limit our inputs, because we have to engage now, get feedback or responses, and then we get into the next sub-theme on the PSET, and then the other one will be on the skills, I think, on the skills. Members, I saw Honorable Mananiso, Honorable Liago, Honorable Letsie, the fighter here. in that order. And Honorable Nodada. You remind me of somebody who had been in a meeting for about 2 hours, actually more than 2 hours. So one of the members just came in, not a member here, in another meeting. As he was walking through the door, his hand was up. And I was wondering, hey, this kid, what's happening here? Does not even know the agenda, what item we are at. He's already set this up, ready to engage. Honorable Mananis.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me firstly acknowledge the presentation to say indeed they have cleared the mist, more especially Professor. Dr. Daniel Fisser, because of when he was elaborating on the presentation, you would get the simplicity of the subject itself. because you would know at times people want to understand what is this 4IR. However, I want to check with each and everyone who has presented, how far are you in terms of transforming your concept document to other indigenous languages? Because I believe that if we speak 4IR as a solution to this society, we need to be having different languages, simplifying the content itself. Because if we are not able to do that, we're going to create the triple challenges as part and parcel of our DNA as South Africans. So that's what I wanted to check. Just to make a joke, this, the DTI, I think you didn't get an indication that we are youthful in this particular portfolio. The font is too big, man. I'm thinking of this presentation, maybe it was supposed to be 7 pages, then we went to 14 pages. However, I want to check with yourselves in terms of what is it that the department could have experienced in terms of challenges that other revolutions, your first, second, and third revolution could have experienced, so that as we move as a country in terms of economic development, we are not back-footed like other revolutions. I thank you.
Honorable Yabo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me acknowledge the presentations that have been made. They have been very enlightening and thought-provoking. I think my input and questions are around one of the most highlighted issues, security. How this revolution in particular poses a threat to security, and not just on various levels, from personal to national, and invasion of privacy, how it borders on the encroaching on the rights of individuals to privacy. And I think one of the most telling is the judgment recently by a court that mass monitoring is not lawful, and how the advancement of these technologies may need to be curtailed in response to their invasion of human privacy. But also, we are a country that has got a relatively high Gini coefficient. The gap between the haves and the have-nots is quite huge. We are also experiencing a lot of capital flight, apparently due to policy uncertainties. But how will the introduction of, not even the introduction, but because a revolution is not spurred on by any factor other than itself, it's got a life of its own. How does the revolution that is happening in the industrial space, coined the 4IR, how will we be able to ensure that we do not further widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots? How will we intend to reskill, upskill, and redeploy to ensure that we do not have massive job losses? Our challenges are unique. We are basically a social democracy. Others may argue that we are a developmental state. I argue we are a social democracy with the bulk of our social net showing signs of us almost being a welfare state. Some things need to be told, almost. We need to be able to have a discussion that speaks to the 4IR, bridging the gap, closing it on the Gini coefficient spaces, as well as the reskilling, upskilling, and redeployment of our cohort, our workforce cohort, to ensure that we do not get left behind, but at the same time we catch up with the rest of the developed world. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Letzia.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Chair. Maybe let's also welcome the presentation. I'm only going to comment on one. I'm going to be very short. I'm actually going to save my time for the next, after the break, Chair. So here I'm just going to make a comment that the Department of the Chief Director, your department, has indeed taken this thing of 4IR seriously, I think, to a certain extent. I know that, in fact, I'm on your website here, and I see you have advertised positions linked to 4IR. In fact, even the description of those posts, at the end, all of them, they speak to 4IR, the data science 4IR, and so forth and so forth. And that is commendable. But my comment is then that as we move towards that digitalization of those things, it's funny that you still require people to sign the Z83 forms handwritten. So it means we're preaching about moving into the digital space, but this thing of paper, we're very strong on it. So maybe we must also try to improve them, maybe have it on your app or something so that people can sign it there and move in that space. But my comment was just on that part, that at least what you are preaching here, what you are saying here, I know that at least in your department you are preaching it, and I think that is commendable. And I just wanted to make that comment in the 1 minute that I was giving. Thanks.
Honorable Gezi.
Where is he? Yeah, it would be great if he was around, because so I think it's always central to understand the fact that this concept of fourth industrial revolution will depend heavily on the kind of curriculum or kind of education that the post school education and training is offering, and even your basic. Well, I'm saying this because, well, of course, for obvious reasons, those are areas where you accumulate knowledge. And when you accumulate knowledge, it depends what kind of knowledge are you accumulating. Is it going to be the knowledge that will, you know, perhaps keep us where we are as the only people who, the only thing we can do is to accept or be the spectators, as they put it correctly in your reports, just to be the spectators of your first industrial revolution, your second and your third. Well, I don't know the kind of efforts that are being made to perhaps look at these curriculums that we're doing so that they are in line and they are integral to these industrializations that are happening. Of course, we cannot fault ourselves for not being innovators like your U.S., as it stated, that they are the first to, discover the first industrial revolution, and England be the second, and all that. I mean, one, if you want to unlearn some of the things, because in a process of trying to, you know, decolonize the kind of education that you are dealing with or transform it, you ought to unlearn some of the things, which is very significant in our view. We agree that it is necessary, who must be, you know, in the same space and times and level with other nations and other countries in as far as the development is concerned. But we ought not to deliberately forget and ignore many, many important aspects that are happening around us. I will focus on one aspect, particularly the mining industry on its own, particularly here in Southern Africa. And we look at the history, the entire history of mining in South Africa and other parts of Southern African countries, and look at, well, maybe the study must be made to check how long did this mining take place, what kind of technology they were using then, because I am of the view, given the, you know, the underground holes that you find in province like Gauteng, and you compare them with the kind of technology that it is currently being used in mining, you would realize that something much more was being used to extract gold in that particular city, as of when you really compare with it with the kind of productivity you are having with the current extraction and mining of other resources. You would realize that so much bigger holes, perhaps maybe we can be enlightened and the research must be conducted. We check how, because we might be thinking that the first industrial revolution happened or came, it was discovered by England or US, only to find out that there is something we are ignoring, some of the things that perhaps we do not know. Hence, I have highlighted that knowledge is very important. And if knowledge is not being transferred, some of the things can be lost in the process, right? So we are saying this because as a young person or someone staying, coming from a despondent area, a remote area, who do not understand the real concepts of 4IR, what do you mean by the fourth industrial revolution, technologies and all that, they must be brought, you know, closer to understand really what do we talk about. How do you convince that person that, you know, people who lived in the medieval period, I mean, your great Mansa Musa, who had so much gold, how did they themselves at that period manage to mine it at such a significant pace and so much of it, being able to even refine it the way they have done and mold it according to the ornaments that they have dealt with at that age and period. And when you look at the first industrial revolution happens around your late 17th and 18th centuries. We know how complex, I mean, even geologists can attest how complex it can be to extract or mine gold. It is not mined through a shallow grave. You have to dig deeper so that you can reach there. And so those are the kind of the conversations we must have, because I have said in the process of learning, you must unlearn some of the things. It does not mean if they are not being spoken about, we must keep quiet. So we ought to then understand how did this, all of these things happen, because we are told that the first and the second, and industrial revolutions happened at those given specific times. And well, of course, we like it or not, if we are spectators, we ought to lose jobs in as far as the fourth industrial revolution is concerned. The only thing that is our people are going to suffer from is, or benefit from, in a long run, it will just be assembling of these robots and they go and take their jobs and many other people's jobs. Because if we cannot somehow acquire knowledge ourselves, be innovative ourselves, and which is one thing that the Department of Science and Technology must be very critical on, because this is what, Chairperson, if you remember, we always stress about that. What are we developing? What kind of innovations are we bringing? When will it end that all these great innovations come abroad? When are we going to be the ones who are at the center stage of really bringing and coming up with these sort of innovations? I mean, you look at internet, and internet by itself, the defense or the military in US have
complete monopoly of internet. They decide what they can do with internet, by the way. So everyone who invents something, directly or indirectly, they will be in charge of that. Then they can manipulate it anyhow to their advantage. So it becomes very important, and we must not think that a human brain is such an amazing part of a human body. Because all these robots that you see around and all these innovations, they are emanating from just a single tiny piece of a human brain. So it can do all amazing things. And we do have such things as South Africans, many of South Africans. So anything innovative must come from a human brain. How do we then help in as far as the post-education system is concerned to really galvanize and catalyze the thinking capacity of our people to be innovative, comrades. Unfortunately, there's no time because there are some of the things I think it's very important we touch on. Yes. And it's important that this colloquium of this nature gets expanded and we engage further so that we enlighten each other about this 4IR, because I think it's been, the term has just been thrown around without a proper understanding what we really mean by the fourth industrial revolution. And it has its owners. It's like it's a concept that is owned by some people and some countries. It's theirs, you know. So we need time to engage on that. Thanks for now, Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll also come back later on after the other presentation. Honorable Nodada, and I see a hand to that side.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and good afternoon to everybody. First of all, Chairperson, I just would like to welcome the presentations. I think Dr. Fiss's presentation to begin with was quite insightful to give a full background of what's happening, and I think I much enjoyed as well the presentation from the Department of Communications when he spoke about what jobs are linked to what is trying to be done. But I'm going to try to be as short as possible and quite succinct and to the point, Chair. But I want to start off by asking a question, Chairperson, that yes, the Deputy Speaker has made a point about this needs to be discussed in clusters, which I think is very important. But I think one of the most important stakeholders as part of this discussion is actually basic education. And I wanted to check whether have they been invited and informed of this type of colloquium, because the type of problems that we receive in post-school education and training, science and technology, or the job market, is a 12-year problem from basic education. I want to make that point very clear. I might sound like a broken record, but it's important. I'll give you a personal experience. So I did my grade 1 in junior senior secondary school, Kutsol, Matlubi. No electricity, no access to the village itself in terms of the road, no running water, no flushing toilets and all that stuff. The type of education that I was receiving in junior secondary school was completely different to when I got the scholarship to go to Kersney College, where the grass is so green that you think you can even eat it. Now, the type of infrastructure, classrooms, teaching that happens at Kersney College versus in junior senior secondary school are completely different. In fact, I think if you stay at Engu and you finish up your schooling, you're most likely to end up in that geographical location, not really informed of what's happening outside of there. I'm mentioning this as a personal experience, as a point, because my biggest worry, as much as I'm excited to hear some of the advances around the fourth industrial revolution, but my biggest fear are the people that are consistently left behind in the third, in the second, and sometimes in the first industrial revolution. So I just wanted to ask a question on all three presenters. What exactly are you doing to make sure that abantu baselalini, people in the rural areas, who acquire this education which Honorable Geze has referred to as curriculum that is unlinked to what we're trying to do or trying to develop or what we want to achieve, what are you exactly doing to make sure that those people are not left behind in the system of developing and advancing the fourth industrial revolution. I think it was a representative of the minister that mentioned this point about maybe it's high time that we actually have a discussion of whether we want to call this whole thing the fourth industrial revolution. Because, you know, tomorrow somebody will come up with the fifth industrial revolution, the sixth industrial revolution, and where does it end? What exactly are we trying to achieve by having this discussion about digitization and any and developing industries, advancing science and technology and creating that culture in terms of achieving socioeconomic prosperity? What do we want to term that? So that when we want to develop a PlayStation 10, instead of focusing on a PlayStation 4, we're able to still do it in that spectrum of what we've defined based on our niche space. Now, I want to go further by saying that there was a science, the SciFest festival, the SciFest, I think, and I attended the SciFest, right? So the different type of learners that come from different types of schools, and I want to emphasize this point because it's very important. Somebody who goes to Gray College or Gray High School could be able to identify 3D printing at the expo, but someone who went to Kamqoboshe, you know, Kukumbu, could not even fathom or was interested in that, right? So that's why I asked the question, the first question about basic education, because it's very important, Chairperson, to link all of this that we're discussing. Which brings me to the next point, to the Department of Communications. All of these current, these list of technology fields which provide foundation for broad job descriptions, Has there been a discussion with the Department of Higher Education, particularly CETAS, TVET colleges, as well as linking that with science and innovation in terms of developing this curriculum to teach these? But beyond that, teaching them is one thing. Whatever, I mean, you've got a very young committee here. Most of us come from the university space. If you go there and you study a Bachelor of Education, whatever you require for you to teach are these type of job descriptions and skills that need to be developed being taught to those teachers for them to transfer the skill. Because that's another thing. And we need to be able to link all of these things together. And it goes back and it boils down to the type of education curriculum that we teach. And it's not just a basic education issue, but it's also that TVET vocational and training space that we need so much in the country to develop these, because universities are not going to do these things on their own. Yes, the universities can do research, advanced scientific research, but some of these technical skills, data analytics, and all these other things must be produced through our TVET system, our CETA system. So that's a question that goes to you in particular. And then my last point, Chairperson. I mean, I've got a lot to say as well, you know, and I think this should be a continuous discussion to have this form of this particular platform. But I just want to make this last point. You know, in many countries that are developing nations or have collapsed while in their development, you'll find that the government controls its people by not educating them. That's how the government controls people, because you won't be able to question anything. In fact, you don't even know what's going on. So the government in this instance must be the leading player with the private sector in the implementation process of whatever we're going to conclude on. Why am I saying this? You can't go to a Home Affairs department. Government one is talking about fourth industrial revolution and, you know, smart cities and broadband and all these things, but a mere department of the same government can't even do those things. You know, can't even use those technologies. That doesn't have Wi-Fi to begin with. Or their staff members can't even use the internet. So it needs to be the leading player. You can't have a discussion on 4IR and you're not the leading player in the discussion, you know. And whatever systems we're using, whether it's for our finances, whether the systems we use for our public services to track data in terms of the healthcare system, it must start with government. Whatever those digital technologies that we're going to be using, that are going to advance the conversation on 4IR must start with government. And I think it's something that maybe the Office of the Deputy Speaker and the Chairperson will take home with them, but I think that's my input. Thank you so much, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much,
Do you have PlayStation at home, Honorable? Not that. Okay. I'm sorry, you'll introduce yourself.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nomashu Bingume. I'm the economic researcher at SAFTU. In the words of Albert Einstein, foolishness is repeating the same thing over and over. And it cannot be that we adopted neoliberal policies in the first, second, and third revolution, which have resulted in millions of South Africa who still do not have skills that will that enable them to thrive in this revolution that we're in. And we also want to go into the fourth industrial revolution to the point that was made on the floor of the state being merely a passive bystander that just offers a legislative environment for organizations to thrive in the 4IR. It cannot be that we go into this fourth industrial revolution with the same mentality. The state has to be an active player. It has to actively ensure that millions of South Africans are not left behind again in the fourth industrial revolution, which will have the potential of just creating another bourgeoisie class, leaving millions and millions behind. I will not say any point further to this point. It's been eloquently put by the previous speaker.
Thank you. Any more takers? Are we done? Honorable Kasha, welcome back from Singapore. Welcome back home. I see a hand there, and then a comrade from Saus will be the last.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, it's very unfortunate that I come back home under these conditions. The passing of Comrade Babalile Hlongwa. People have said a lot, so I'm not going to say much for once. Singapore was an interesting experience, you can imagine, when it comes to 4IR. As I was leaving the flight, as I was leaving the airport, giving them back their currency, I turned around and I saw this, what do you call that machine that shines the floor? And it was moving on its own. And I looked around and then I looked for the person who's holding maybe like a something that's trying to operate this thing. And I was like, okay, this is for IR. And of course I was fascinated by that. So then I recorded that and I shared it somewhere. And then I walked to where you're supposed to, in South Africa, I guess that would be our security check. Yeah, that is our security check. Then I walked to the security check, and there was no one there. There was just like, what do you call them, like booms, where you place your passport, and then the second boom, you place your finger, and then that's it. Literally didn't interact with anybody. And I thought to myself, okay, of course, what does this mean for employment? That's the first thing that came to my mind. What does this mean for employment? Okay, of course, I'm fascinated. You're so cool. You know, it just opens. But the biggest thing on my mind was, what does that mean for employment? And, of course, it trickled down to the conversation around gender in the space of 4IR. I mean, women have always been on the back foot in terms of the presentation in most revolutions, industrial revolutions. So how do we imagine the fourth industrial revolution as it is unfolding to unfold in a manner that doesn't deepen gender disparities within our society? I mean, I think a lot of the times when you give at the security check, when I think of it in a South African context, a lot of the time I'm actually giving my passport, my boarding pass to a woman. So those are some of the thoughts that were going through my mind at that particular point in time. I'm very passionate about the idea of 4IR making government services more effective and efficient. A conversation that's come up in our committee a lot under higher education has been that how do we ensure that our data systems And that speaks to what the Deputy Speaker was saying about how dynamic the ecosystem of this conversation is. If a student is captured on the SASSA database, why do they still have to affirm themselves when they get to university as someone who's indigent? How does telecoms, us creating technologies, the data, all of that, how does that come together to ensure that indigent beings don't have to continuously prove their indigence? Can't I just get somewhere, put my finger somewhere, and then everybody knows that this is who I am, and then I'm finished? You know, in fact, actually, at some point, I was thinking, why do I even have to carry my ID anyway? Even the cops, if they want to see who I am, why do I have to have my driver's license? Because I might forget it in the other car, like whatever. Can't I just put my finger somewhere, and you know who I am, you know how many tickets I have, you captured. And I don't know. I know with the facial recognition, it's a bit faulty. My little sister's face can open my iPhone. But I don't know. I've got a feeling that the algorithms, is that what it's called? I don't know. Of the finger are a bit better. So perhaps the fraudulency of fake identity documents could be dealt with. So we're dealing with legal matters at the same time, but we're increasing our innovative ways as a government. So I'm just thinking about, like, really, I think, cool things that can really help us develop our country and make sure that our service provision is much is better. I also want to raise the idea of decoloniality. And I think Comrade Jane spoke about it to an extent when she spoke about the usage of language, of African languages. And which speaks largely to the idea of decoloniality, and how do we see this artificial intelligence unfold in an African context? And I don't have the answer, but I mean, when you, and I'm exposing my youth here, but when you like look at Wakanda, and of course it's like fiction, but it's like fiction that could inspire for us to really become an African continent that is extremely advanced. So how do we see some of the things that we saw, that I've seen in Singapore, for example, that we've seen in other parts of Europe, find expression on our continent, in our country, but in a manner that truly speaks to the socialization of African beings? So those are some of the thoughts that I have on my mind. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of answers, but that's just the contributions that I have today, Chair. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Gentleman at the back.
Hello. Okay. Thank you very much. I am Sabelo Sibanda. I'm a researcher at the PAC, Pan-Africanist Congress. I'll speak to the presentation by Professor Swartz, I hope I pronounced it right, on the importance of relanguaging. I call it relanguaging, where he talks about, as against the fourth industrial revolution, Professor.
Okay.
Yeah. As against the fourth industrial revolution, they talk more about the social revolution because of the societal impact of this revolution, so-called, in the sense that it's not enough to lament the inequalities without looking at the impact of what this revolution is doing to those who are already outside the inner circle of technology in the first place. I am told of a scenario where an institution insourced workers. After insourcing the workers, they chose to introduce machines in the cafeteria. Those workers who had been working in the cafeteria were immediately disposed of. And we are not saying much about that particular aspect. And then the presentation by Ms. Mruena, slide number 3, where you talk about the urgent interventions. I think you need to introduce a fifth intervention, because the interventions that you have put in as urgent all talk to mechanical items, but there is nothing about the people. There is no intervention that urgently speaks to how we will ensure that people do not end up being victims of this revolution. So I think personally it's a serious priority that as we advance in the process of industrializing in this manner, we ensure that the unemployment figures do not increase whilst we believe that we are advancing in the process. And I don't hear much about the protection element. We seem to see this merely in its positive light. We've seen already how the music industry has been impacted negatively by internet piracy. Maybe we should be thinking as well about how we introduce protective measures for our artists in that regard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Lastly, from Saus.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think just as an introduction, my name is Thabo Shinkanyi, spokesperson of Saus. I won't say much, Chairperson, because I think Honorable
South African Union of Students.
Sorry, the South African...
Yeah, well, in our sector, so we are used to Saus, this and that. There's another one in the TVET, what is it called?
Safeta.
Safeta. I was struggling myself, but now... Okay,
I
sure.
think a more simpler definition, well, an SRC of SRC, basically. I think, Chairperson, I think it's honorable, not that I raises the point quite cogently around the issue of fourth industrial revolution and also taking to cognizance our where we find ourselves as a country, particularly in the educational space. The many disparities, he highlights them from a basic education level to a higher education level. But I think we're not having an honest conversation around the issue of fourth industrial revolution and whose interests does it primarily serve. I'll make an example. We go to many universities across the country, University of Venda, I always cite University of Venda as the face of historically disadvantaged universities. And I cite this merely because I was once called to come and speak at University of Venda on the fourth industrial revolution. And I was preparing all of these documents and, you know, presentation. And I got there and I said, but what conversation are we having when you've barely gone through, with inverted commas, the first industrial revolution in a university like Venda, for instance? And so in whose interest does it serve when it comes to issues of the infrastructure, the issue of what the 4IR seeks to, you know, envision and seek to achieve in the broader things of society? I like the comment that was made, I'm not too sure, by the lady there, who suggests that the state itself cannot be a bystander in the question of the fourth industrial revolution. Basic education, we're talking about TVET colleges, for instance. We're talking about, there's one thing about curriculum, there's another thing about the infrastructure for this thing. We can't be teaching fourth industrial revolution as if we're in apartheid and how many insects enter the room and you're teaching mathematics. You need the infrastructure for these things, the necessary technologies. Right now we're having a crisis in, unfortunately, Safeta is not here to raise these things, in particular around the TVET sector. But if a serious issue about, around infrastructure in the TVET sector, we're talking fourth industrial revolution, how are you going to teach even this curriculum that you want to change, and how are you going to administer it to the particular student and broaden the issues of education in this particular country? So I think these are the conversations that need to be ongoing around the fourth industrial revolution, and not just limited or rush this conversation. I think we're really rushing this conversation. There are many things we must be considering, ethical considerations. I mean, there's a student who's writing a thesis, I think, at University of Pretoria around the ethics of artificial intelligence. You know, at some point, these things are going to take over the role of people. They're going to become so destructive in their operations. How do you even look into those kind of particular aspects? So I think when you begin to rush the conversation around IR and serve a particular interest, your urban areas, etc. We're not really having an honest conversation, nor are we utilizing it in the best interest of the broader constituency of this particular country. And I must say this as a personal view. I mean, these are the debates that come out even from universities. Many university students are rejecting the notion of 4IR. You're having many seminars to say, in fact, it can happen in Europe. We are still stuck in the first industrial revolution here. We're still I come from Limpopo myself. No water, no electricity. I can imagine when I go there not to talk about fourth industrial revolution, who am I speaking to? And, you know, so it's these kind of conversations we must really be having very honestly moving forward. 5G is only being launched in Cape Town, for instance. We are talking about 5G communication. In whose interest does the fourth industrial revolution primarily serve? I'll leave it at that for now because I think Prof. Janssen will elaborate further. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we must recruit you to our committee to come and join Honorable Gates here so that we can continue to have this lively discussion, bit of fun there. So I hope this barrage of questions, you are ready to respond to them. Some of them are comments. It would have been ideal that we engage with all of this after receiving the other presentation, because others may also overlap into the others. I heard the whip was talking about an Honorable Gates decolonized education system. What does it mean? And that is on the next theme that we are supposed to get into. So, but otherwise, let's give you an opportunity then to respond to the questions.
Thank you, Chair. Should I kick it off in terms of first presentation?
Yeah, you can. Can you kick off? Yeah.
Did you have any comments? Well, I think
Imran is running away. He will come. Don't worry. He will have to come. You can shoot now.
I just want to kick one thing off. I think if we had to respond to all of these very valuable comments, I think we'd be here for another 2 hours before we even start the next session. So I don't think we can cover all of them. A lot of the comments are noted, and they're very valuable inputs in the way that we plan things. And I also don't want to really go too much into skilling and upskilling in education, as that will be the topic of discussion for the rest of the morning. One thing I do want to say in terms of sort of the whose 4IR is this? And it reminds me of a question that I got at, it was a J.B. Marks Foundation session, in that somebody asked me, how far behind are we? And it strikes me as behind who? You know, if we're saying we're far behind, then we're saying we're far behind somebody else's plan. Because we've really got to look at what does this mean for South Africa? How are we going to adopt this? What kind of things are we going to do? And so are we behind? I don't believe we are. We need to develop this for ourselves. So when we talk about, and the comments around basic education are very valuable, the comments about higher education are very valuable, the comments about adoption of technologies and having the government drive that adoption of technologies through example are very valuable. Let's do that for ourselves. We don't need to follow the plan of anybody else. We can use technologies that have been developed elsewhere in the world. We don't have to develop all of these things ourselves, but how we adopt them, how we use them to address societal issues, particularly Deputy Speaker spoke about the inequality, poverty, how we use them to address those issues is the plan that we're developing now through the Presidential Commission. We're doing that for South Africa, so we're not behind anybody. We do have to realize, and I come back to the very last point now, we cannot ignore it. We cannot say we're still struggling with electricity and water and digital, early digital skills, so therefore we reject the notion of the fourth industrial revolution. These technologies, these advances are happening around the world. As a country, we have to remain competitive if we want to continue to grow our economy. We can't ignore it, okay?
How we adopt it, how we bring these things on board is very important, but it's a South African thing, and we have to do it ourselves. And I just wanted to address also the issue around language. It's a very good point, and I'll definitely take that on board and a lot of the things that we're doing. But going back to technology, and you spoke about facial recognition and things like that, it's very important that Africans have a look at digital biometrics, because facial recognition does not work, because there isn't enough data that has been inputted about African faces. There isn't enough data that has been inputted around African languages and African inflections and African accents. That is work that we have to do, that we have to develop all of those things. So the area of sovereignty, the area of digital identity, is extremely important for us to start developing. And I know Trudy will have a go at me around the blockchain for ensuring that we don't have to continuously enter data, and that our data around our qualifications and the nature and the value of our qualifications is just consistent, so that when you do put a fingerprint somewhere, they can tell you exactly what you have done, what you've studied, how valuable that is, etc. So those kind of things we are definitely developing, and we're going at it, but it's for Africa. We don't need to worry about what the Europeans are doing in this space. We need to do it for Africa. And I'll leave it there for Nache.
Okay, thank you very much. We follow the sitting arrangement. You can come in, madam.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think I'd like to thank you for the input and comments. I think most of them are around skilling, and the next session will address them. But with regards to the issue of security, I think it's a very important and urgent issue that we need to address as a country, especially in terms of policies and legislation. I know there has been a cybercrime policy that has been put through, but I think the sort of agency to sort of attend to it, because now when you have this technologies, the drones flying around, they pose quite a serious security issue, and also the advent of social media, etc., and issues of privacy and personal data. So I think from a government perspective, it's something that we don't have to wait for the country strategy on 4IR, but as government we need to pay attention to. On the issue of the divide, I think with this one, as much as the 4IR is posing a challenge around job losses, but there are sort of positives to say we will indeed lose jobs, but we will also at the same time create quality jobs. For example, with regards to mining, for example, if you replace a miner who is working with a big machine with a robot, then it means that you have to reskill that person and allow the robot to do sort of the work that the person can do that can pose danger to that person, and reskill them on other areas. So it's one area that I think the work stream on the commission is looking at such issues and coming up with sort of recommendations around that aspect. So I think most of the issues that were raised, we do take them in, and I will also, from my side, also share them with the commission as they engage to also attend to them so that the strategy is comprehensive and address these issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. Nimrod.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, apologies to Honourable Mananiso about the size of the font on the presentation. I More seriously, the I think the one theme that cut across many of the issues raised by the members was really about how do we deal with the impact of technological change on jobs and inequality. I think that the one thing that we can probably all agree on, and I think probably we'll get into in the following session, is that it's really important to address the education system running right through from basic to tertiary education around literacy, numeracy, maths and science skills, and STEM skills. But we also know that that is a long-term challenge. I think when in the past, when there have been processes of technological change, they've often the issue of jobs and job losses has historically always come up. And I think the truth is we don't really know, you know, exactly what the impact is going to be on jobs. But I think there are very real risks that we could lose jobs, particularly because I think this process is making it's kind of generating a more skill-intensive economy for people to participate. But having said that, I think that there are significant opportunities, particularly that we need to focus on in the medium term as we build up the capabilities to engage more broadly with the fourth industrial revolution, around looking at what kind of areas are there where if we have the insertion of technology and skills are job complementing rather than job displacing. And I think there are some areas in our economy where there's significant potential to expand employment and where you might require a relatively small amount of, you know, additional technological capacity and skills to unlock quite a significant amount of relatively unskilled employment. So, I mean, one area that's certainly overlooked is high-value agriculture. A lot of horticultural activities, fruit and related type of activities, are actually very sophisticated. But at the same time, you know, by having relatively targeted improvements in technology, in growing the produce, in getting it, you know, fresh through the cold chain from South Africa into export markets, you can create many, many jobs. I mean, the Bureau for Agricultural Policy estimates that about 200,000 direct jobs could be created in this space. And that's where technology and skills actually can complement employment creation. I think there are a range of manufacturing sectors where investments, fixed investments, including in machinery and skills and so forth, are complementary. When investment rises, jobs increase in sectors like metals, plastics, machinery, food, clothing, and so forth. I think there are also other areas where, you know, where maybe it's not directly a big technological issue right now, but it's really about, you know, reviving sectors like the construction sector, you know, where it's about reviving, finding ways to revive demand in the construction sector. So those are my overall comments on the link between jobs and not deepening kind of inequality and exclusion.
Okay, Honourable Deputy Speaker.
Thank you very much. This has been a very interesting discussion. Firstly, I'd like to say to the committee, I've just given you, the secretary of the committee here, two propaganda pieces. as a direct question, the gentleman is out now. I guess he's from fresh air outside the member of the committee.
Not that.
Sorry? I have an answer for him, and he will get it through, and all members of the committee will get it. It's the speech of the Minister of Basic Education in the 2017 State of the Nation Address debate. It's there and answers his questions directly. So there's work that's underway, that's happening there. That's the first part. The second one is also to the researcher from the PSC. That your last comment on what's happening in the music and art industry to protect them. When we had the post-State of the Nation address this year, I think it's this year, yes, we had an expo of what's being designed, what's happening for real. And one of them was young people who demonstrated what you call blockchain there, some mechanism for imprinting on your song, on your artwork, so that anybody who copies it or steals it can be traced quickly and fast, and that people will get the money from whoever takes it. They won't get it for free. So there's protection already in that direction. So let me also add that because we want these technologies to address issues in rural areas and so on, there was also someone who was displaying a contraption that is intended to bring rural areas into the sphere without traditionally laying cables and stuff like that for access to the internet, which assumes in the first place we are doing enough work to build education in the rural areas so that internet is provided for. Their goal was by 2021 to have covered all rural areas in South Africa. So there's an assumption that something's going to happen there. And the gentleman from the students, you know, I bet that his constituency and those who were rejecting the fourth industrial revolution have got profiles already on the ether. So they were, as they were talking to him, they were probably texting and doing all sorts of things as they reject the fourth industrial revolution. So I really would like to recruit him to join me because there are interesting things that I would like to share with him. That is already underway, about which there's huge impact, including one of the calls is for, in the overall syllabi, including for adults, learning how to learn, which is becoming the new skill. As jobs, for example, in the area of accounting and accounting practices, including incidentally in the legal environment, there are things that machines are going to do faster, so lawyers are going to have to refocus. People who do legal research, artificial intelligence is going to do that quicker, faster, to enable judges and magistrates to deliver judgment. So fast, it's not going to be nice for those who used to spend weeks in libraries searching legal libraries for case studies and so on. Artificial intelligence does it quicker, faster, and then the judgment is now left in the head of a judge. If this is the evidence before us, how do we deliver the judgment? The obvious, someone mentioned this here, the racial impact of technologies, because whoever designs it, not out of malice, his or her biases are going to be in what is designed. For example, somebody wanted to, an African guy wanted to wash his hands under a soap dispenser. It couldn't read his skin. He didn't deliver. And then he tested, he just waited around in the loo for someone else with a lighter skin. And when that person put his hands under this thing, oh, the soap came out. Now, this is already happening. When you arrive from Swaziland or from whatever country via the airport, as you enter there, there's a machine that focuses on you so that it catches any disease you must be bringing into the country. From Singapore, she would be aware that when she entered the OR Tambo, there was a camera pointed at her as she enters, so that any disease she brings back, Rubata Mufau, we don't want the disease. The disease must be caught. If she has it, she's going to be put aside and quarantined and dealt with. So it's already happening. It's not something that's going to come in the future. Already today,
in our members' facilities here, when we walk in there, there's nobody serving us tea there. There's a machine, you press whatever you want from a machine. Sorry, my French is disappeared. The machine already offers you coffee with milk, with sugar and stuff like that. There's no one there, okay? But these are elements of where these things are already being deployed for a variety of reasons. Our concern as Parliament is to oversee the development of a strategy that will enable us to harness the advantages but deal with the risks that we haven't quite listed as yet, apart from saying there's a risk of deepening levels of inequality, of poverty and unemployment. There's a risk for that. And that, by the way, someone also speculates that yes, we will do new jobs, but there'll be high-level quality jobs, okay? So we will not be able to cope with producing enough jobs to meet the damage that's going to happen. So our challenge is the quality of education and intervention for retraining, and this is why this story about learning how to learn is so critical. My favorite pet subject, adult education. How do we help adults who are going suddenly to find themselves unable to do the jobs they have spent their lives studying and so on? I mean, a long time ago, some engineer in the United States claimed, if at the end of 3 years you are an engineer, you are not continually studying, you are going to find yourself completely irrelevant to the sector you thought you understand, and you are going to fall by the wayside. So there are risks that we must, as the public sector, insist that our government must have an overall strategy and intervene swiftly to prevent what will be huge consequences. Tax. You have someone mentioned this. Yeah, these guys must pay tax in our countries. We want digital sovereignty in the first place. This is an important part we want to suggest. We cannot operate without digital. We must benefit from the connection. The presentation there showed relationship we must have with what's happening in the world. But equally, we have to ourselves, because of the specific conditions we are operating under, develop our own, and like the PAC research question, we must protect the interests of the producers of good stuff. I do want to suggest someone wrote a book called Shift, in which he says three critical skills that are consequential to this development. Away from consumption to production, to producing things. The beauty of producing things instead of buying them, your reputation depending on what you buy and so on and so on. To producing, but from generalist to a master in one or two areas. So we deepen that part of the work. There's a third one. But the point about it is that this idea of protecting jobs, but building speed with which workers can generate skills, new skills and acquisition, and resources being placed in that, it already exists partly as in the Labor Relations Act that requires you, if you are to retrench, if you think the things are going bad in your sector, you must introduce skills training to enable those workers to be able to be employable beyond where they are at and so on. These developments are introducing new challenges and new vulnerabilities. And as Parliament, as the legislative sector broadly, we need to be alert to those vulnerabilities with which we can't not have policies in place and legislative. The courts, it's correct, they're already making decisions on these matters. For example, those students who are thinking of rejecting the so-called 4IR are in trouble because they are messaging. Their text, a legal contract. If you say things there that is out of order, you will be taken to task, so they must be careful. Social media, we were almost beaten up, okay, I must not put it so badly. In Zanzibar during a Commonwealth Parliamentary Association meeting, because the comments by a deputy minister who is no longer a deputy minister and happened in the previous administration, were resurfaced into the CIFA, in which he was talking nonsense about foreigners. Okay? And he was chided by the president after he said that. And in many ways, he was chided. And he's no longer a minister. But When these things happened in Gauteng, those things were put out of the cyberspace, recirculated, and the anger with which people as a result were saying that if Deputy Minister can say this, what can we expect from South Africa? So social media and the stuff that comes in there, fake news and the manipulation of events and so on through social media, is a dangerous environment which constitutes a risk, which if we do not, including by students, as he is talking about there, we don't manage it even for personal purposes. The stuff that goes into that thing can be resurfaced in a very embarrassing way when least expecting them to happen. They constitute part of the vulnerability that is emerging that we must guard. Us as public representative, let's remember that the personal is political. That the private, what we do in private, can be very soon public. It serves as a warning. It serves as a guide of personal practice. We don't have to be public representative to be done. Even our families, we must draw their attention to the reality that is now brought about by this thing. They're not going to wait for us to have policies. I do wish we can operate with speed. I agree that we must deepen our engagement and consultation, but we can't operate slowly like a village cow. We have to be faster. Thank you, Ndati.
Like a village cow. Imran, I'm not too sure if the protocol allows talking after the deputy speaker, but there's this one comment that I want to make, and this is drawing on what Daniel had indicated, and just to illustrate with some of the comments made by the honourable members of the committee. If we talk about data systems as an example, one of the things that would be interesting for Parliament to look at is whether the legislation that we pass in fact built in certain technological weaknesses. I mean, I'll give you an example. When we do most pieces of legislation, we look at institutions, sometimes we look at information systems. How do you craft the policy provisions around information systems? Do they force interoperability as an example? So I see a lot of times that bills come through, and whether it's land, deeds, registry or whatever, we think about these things as individual information systems and not part of a collective information system. Z83 is as an example. You know, is there some weaknesses? So there's a need to see also how legislation becomes an enabler for the new technologies. And to illustrate the second example which Daniel mentioned, most people naturally are verbal. Text, in fact, is the reason why we have a keyboard was because the technology for voice was not advanced. That's why you have a keyboard on a computer. If we had the technology to be able to speak, you would have never had keyboards because people would speak into the systems. So the new bases, and that's why we type in a way. If you can talk and you can type, why can't we do this? Voice recognition has immensely progressed over time. We have languages, so even when we want to do things like language translation, we think about the legislation and say it's not possible. Each department should have things only in three languages. We're not creating the demand for language technologies. Because if you are saying that this is the requirement, you've got 5 years to do this, eventually everything has to be in 11 languages, but then facilitate the technologies. I've been using voice text translation, whether it's from Afrikaans or Zulu, whatever, because when you do the Twitter, then, you know, someone like me who's disadvantaged in seeing a thread, I just copy it into Google Translate, and it does it, and it's extremely good. It's emerged tremendously. So partly a lot of these technologies and ideas about doing these things, these nice things to have, are constrained by the institutions, by the systems we've created, whether it's information or whether it's the voice recognition, etc. And I think it would be useful to kind of look at it when you do they talk about socioeconomic assessments on pieces of legislation. You also introduce a step where you say, what's the consequence in terms of digitalization? Get an independent opinion
to be able to do it so that we can be at the cutting edge. We don't necessarily have the long institutional challenges that we have. So just as an example, there are things like that that can really, we can work in concert to catalyze a lot of the things, as Daniel has said, to create a really South African, very inclusive, fourth industrial revolution to deal with the challenges that we want to do. And that's why I mentioned in the opening remark, we have these big challenges like health, education, water and sanitation. First industrial and second industrial revolution problems, but you can think about them in a very different way by applying the current technologies in those spaces. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Chairperson, I'm sorry, man. Can I just, because he triggered something I forgot, and let me put it so. The comrade from the Department of Communication will help us. In the 90s, when what was then called the Information Highway was introduced, we created the CETA, the State Information Communication Technology. Now, its house was based on four legs. I forget the fourth one. But the first one was what he called interoperability of systems. The next one was security. And the third one was convenience. Now, there's a fourth one. I forget the fourth one. As the four legs of our information system that we should bring about. The ambition behind it was that we would effectively break the silos of departments and how they tend to operate. And this is partly why I refer to clusters, because this operating in clusters also perpetuates fragmentation that kills not only resource availability and use, but also effective piggybacking on each other to make the biggest impact. So we must go back to resuscitate those four pillars and in fact design our state machinery, and this reconfiguration of government I was suggesting earlier on gives us an opportunity to do that, to integrate from below. Here, this committee here can be very forceful in demanding integration from below to put into place this criteria for accepting legislation. How does it take on board the developments that are taking place in the health environment? There are extremely exciting developments in the health environment. If it is true that in every household, urban and rural, there's roughly one or two cell phones, the possibility for people getting health and being interviewed and as a result getting assistance is huge. It's a potential. Until we resource that environment, we can make the biggest impact in the majority of people instead of only the well-heeled. And so on. Yeah. Thanks, Chairperson. And may
okay. Thank you very much. We are now entering into the second. We are doing terribly. We are terribly behind schedule. We have got three speakers there who are going to speak to us. We've got Professor Jonathan Johnson. I'd like to invite him to come and take a chair there. We've got Professor Charlene Swartz from the HSRC. And then we're going to have Ms. Tiffany Veig from the Department of Higher Education and Training. I'm going to ask that we need to rush. I know that we're not going to do justice to your presentations. But yeah, we're going to speak more about the role of PSED and STI sectors towards building the skills for innovation-based economy.